Hey, everybody, welcome back. Thank you very much for tuning in. You are listening to the Dom and Colin podcast. My name is Colin. I am back again with Dom. Dom, it has been quite a while. How have you been?
Yeah, it's been almost a month, and you were very insistent that we not let a month go by without having some form of podcast out there, and there's been a lot to talk about, so this isn't a bad time to be doing one.
Well, okay, this is my whole thing, is we've been doing this podcast for coming up on 5 years now. We have never had a calendar month go by where we did not put out a podcast. We are currently, it is, as I often do, date the podcast within 30 seconds of starting it. It's 11:20 p.m. on the East Coast here on July 30th. We so far haven't posted a podcast in the month of July. I don't want to let a month go by without a podcast going up there because I feel like once you let 1 month go by, then we are prone to start letting 2 months go by, and it just becomes a slippery slope, Dom.
I swear there was like a few summers ago we were on hiatus for like a month and a half or 2 months or something, but maybe my mind is just playing tricks on me.
No, you're absolutely right that we went like a month and a half without doing a podcast, but because we waited so long, like we timed it so that it spanned out between the 2 months. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was very smart of us back then, whenever it was.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be editing this in a total panic, trying to get this up in time, but I'm glad that we can get something up there for July. It has been so long, and I'm really glad to be back. We have a lot to be getting to today.
Yeah, I'll do my best to make sure it's not too hard to edit. And yeah, there's so much to talk about. And hopefully we will still have some listeners left by the time we're done with talking about all of this. Although, depending on how hot the takes are, maybe we won't. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, Dom, we are back today to be talking about, with only Big Brother 18 really going on at this point for us in the world of actual reality TV, I'm going to say the best reality TV show on television right now, which is the U.S. election, the Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton 2016 campaign for presidency. We talked a little bit about this during the end of one of our Brexit podcasts, but we're going to talk a lot more about it today. And then actually afterwards, after we've talked about all that, we are going to check back in with Brexit. So for the people who want to hear about the fallout from that, Dom certainly has plenty to tell us about from that as well.
Yeah, and if you don't want to hear any Brexit spoilers, then tune out after that part and we can save that for another time.
Yeah. Well, I should say before we get into everything going on today that we are going to be back very soon, by the way, for Genius fans with our Genius Season 3 in Review Part 3 coming up shortly, and also for fans of both Genius and Survivor, which I'm guessing most people listening to this podcast are fans of at least Survivor, they will be very familiar with Josh Wigler. Of course, everyone knows him for his work covering Survivor and working for The Hollywood Reporter and all he does on RHAP. He is going to be finally coming on to the podcast. We're going to be talking, just going in-depth, a deep dive into Survivor as a franchise, as well as The Genius as a franchise, and what makes both of them so great. Really, really excited to have Josh coming on. That's going to be in a couple days, even from now. So that'll be up very soon by the time that you guys are even hearing this. So very much looking forward to that. And Dom, I think without further ado, what do we have? Where do we even want to start getting into this? I know we just had the conventions go down for both the Republicans and the Democrats. Let's start out by finding out how closely is England following all of this? Is this something that's in your newspapers a lot, or however you take your news? I guess it's not newspapers these days, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So in the British media, there's a lot of information about it. So much of that, of the space and the airtime devoted to it has been swallowed up by Donald Trump, and so a lot of it is just like staring aghast at the latest affront to common human decency that Trump has managed to come out with on whatever day it is, and so you don't actually hear that much about the mechanics of the race, about Hillary Clinton and the Democratic campaign in general, or about the wider political situation in the U.S. A lot of it is just, look at this thing that Trump said now, oh God, we're all screwed if he actually makes it in.
Right. Is there an overwhelming sense because of what a disaster this would be if they let Trump actually get the presidency? Because I feel like I remember hearing that Europe in general was very against George W. after his first term and really wanted John Kerry to win there, and was very much in love with Obama in 2008. So is there like an overwhelming sense, I guess, of anti-Trump?
If you thought Obama was a celebrity in the U.S., you have seen nothing compared to what it was like in Europe. You know, everyone was just absolutely in love with him. Even people who would have identified as on the right of the political spectrum, just everybody was head over heels in love with Obama. And I remember being in our equivalent of high school during that time. You would struggle to find one person who not only didn't support McCain or some other candidate, but who wasn't actively in love with Obama. It was just completely all-pervading. And I wouldn't say that died down, but it's just as he became president and he wasn't like this insurgent underdog who was always in the media anymore, and just he was just a fact of life politically, that died down a little bit. But I think overall, Europe is still highly appreciative of Obama and always has been over his over his two terms. But yeah, the attitude of Trump is basically, this guy is the apocalypse on legs. Like, if he gets elected, there's no flaw on how bad this could possibly get. And I think it's hard to speak for mainland Europe, but certainly in the UK, I don't think there's one mainstream politician or media figure who has had anything good to say about Trump, other than people who make their careers out of being explicitly contrarians, like the Katie Hopkins of the world, if that's a name you're familiar with. But I imagine as the election draws closer, there will be some people who recognize that there will be a lot of airtime to be had, maybe a lot of money to be made in being the one person in the whole of the UK who is outwardly supporting Trump. You'll get a lot of hate for it, but maybe your voice will be out there. You'll be called to appear on all of the news shows and everything. So maybe that's an opportunity that some people will see fit to pursue.
Well, I was going to ask. It seems like now that Brexit is over, Nigel Farage needs someone else to troll. So why not go become the one Trump supporter in England?
Well, Nigel Farage has had a quiet but nonetheless messy exit from the political stage, and I'm sure we'll get on to when we talk about Brexit. But yeah, there's really certainly no mainstream support. And then even on the fringes, a lot of the UKIP types are not positively disposed towards Trump either. So you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody who is willing to put themselves out there for him.
What do you guys call high school? You said that you were in what we would consider high school. What do you guys call it?
I guess just secondary school. I mean, my school had a sixth form tacked onto that. So like when you're like 16 to 18, which is because like in the US, you have middle school and then high school, right? And then in the UK, often those are just lumped together. But then sometimes you would go somewhere for the first part and then elsewhere for the second part.
So essentially middle school and high school.
Yeah.
Okay. So why not just call them that? I don't know. I just thought it was interesting. I didn't realize that you didn't call them that. It seemed like very natural and obvious things to call it. Dumb? Okay. All right. If the people at home could see the eye roll that I'm getting from Dom right now for berating British culture and their lack of sensibility when it comes to naming their schools. Dom, I think let's get into the Republican National Convention. This was the big event out in Cleveland. This happened first. So let's start here. Do they have, in your kind of multi-party situation over in England, do they have big convention events like this, or are they much smaller settings to get your candidates?
So we have the party conferences, and those are yearly events. So there's a lot less fanfare surrounding them. It's not seen as like this big thing that the whole four-year cycle is building towards. Instead, it's just a regular thing, a formality in the political calendar. And those are, you compare them to the theater that comes with the DNC and the RNC. These are paltry affairs by comparison. It's often all of the party faithful and all of the senior party figures get shipped off to some dying, decaying seaside town to liven up their local economy for a week or two. And everyone is crammed in this fairly small convention hall. No one's really excited about anything that's going on. And in years where there isn't an election coming up or where there's no leadership election, a lot of it is just routine speeches by senior figures in the cabinet or the shadow cabinet. But a lot of the work is done with like networking behind the scenes and like these fringe policy meetings where they're talking about various things. It's more like a corporate event than it is an actual political event or something that's made for television in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's interesting because this election certainly feels like, to me, almost must-see TV. Like, it's almost as if it's being deliberately played up to be that way. Like, Trump is constantly referencing the ratings for all the things that he's doing and how much free publicity he's giving to these news stations. And when Melania, who we'll talk about shortly, had her big plagiarism scandal, his comment the next morning on Twitter was, I'm so proud that Melania was the top story this morning. Like, it doesn't even seem to concern him what is making the news as long as the cameras are constantly on him. And it really seems like that is what's gotten him this far in the campaign. So who can honestly blame him at this point?
Right. Trump seems to be the walking embodiment of this idea that all news is good news. And as long as you get your name out there in the media, as long as you are the center of attention, then that can only be a good thing regardless of what's actually being said about you. And it's hard to say that he's wrong about that so far. Like, for as much as he is going out of his way to offend every single possible group, it seems like his poll numbers now maybe it's subtly worse than it looks because those are capped at a certain point because of everyone that he's alienated. But it seems like so many people that he just tore apart during the Republican primaries are falling in line behind him in this very craven, cowardly way. And it's obviously a lot harder to win over a mainstream audience where there are so many different groups to appeal to. But if he's able to pull it off, then the election could be a lot closer than anyone's really giving it credit for at the moment.
Right. I think it's a probably inadvertently great strategy when he was campaigning against how many people were up on that stage at the beginning. There were like 12 to 16 people up on that stage at certain points. When there are that many people that have to share all the camera time and that they have to give time to make yourself the focal point of every single question and every single discussion that gets had the next day about the debate is a great way to draw up some publicity for yourself, drum up some publicity for yourself, and make yourself like the focal point of that entire party for that. And when so many votes are getting spread between so many people, he won several states with like 17 to 20% of the vote. And then as people kept losing and dropping out, they would just, for whatever reason, then lump on with Trump.
And it also ensures that he basically has to spend $0 on advertising because the entire media, or the vast majority of whom are aligned in their hatred of him, are doing their work doing his work for him. Like he doesn't need to, you know, beg them. He doesn't need to spend a lot of money to put his name out there because that he's getting wall to wall coverage 24/7, and he doesn't even have to do anything other than be himself to cultivate that.
Right. It's ironic, I suppose, when his message is vote for me because I'm the guy who's going to overcome this corrupt political system with this crazy liberal media bias, and then the liberal media is putting him on the screen 24/7 saying, look at how crazy this guy is, we can't let him in, but the voters are seeing, wow, look at that liberal bias he's talking about, I better vote Trump.
Well, that's the genius of it as well, because we see a lot of candidates, especially on the center and center right and on the far right too, define themselves in opposition to like liberal media bias and PC culture and so on. Trump is the first one, as far as I can remember, to really harness that successfully and to make that the center point of his campaign, to the extent that now, whenever he says something that goes against like the mainstream GOP orthodoxy, he can spin that around and say, well, that's just the media putting a slant on what I said. But then also, whenever he gets criticized, that adds further fuel to the fire because that is exactly what he's criticizing. So when he comes out there and says, the media's biased against me, everyone hates me, we are the true underdogs, and then the way that the media reports that is, look at this outrageous thing that Trump has said, look at how unfit he is to be president. The audience that he is very carefully appealing this to and tailoring his message towards looks at that and says, well, he's right. You know, everything that he says is being confirmed by the people who he identifies as his enemies and our enemies. And so he's able to drum up that level of support with the implicit help of everyone he's railing against in the process. It's like, so for as much as Trump, and I'm sure we'll get onto this, for as much as he knows nothing about the actual political process, his political instincts, as displayed in this campaign so far, have been very on point. And it's you think if you had someone who had those instincts but also wasn't completely toxic and anathema to, you know, half of the mainstream electorate, that would be a very scary candidate for the Democrats to run against.
Well, I think another way that Trump is like almost unintentionally benefited along the same lines as taking such a polarizing approach, being so smart when you're up against that many different competitors splitting votes, is he got very lucky, I think, to be up against exactly Hillary Clinton. Like, as we'll get on to, there is no more despised figure from the right's point of view over the last, you know, in the modern era than Hillary Clinton, including Bill Clinton, including Barack Obama, including Michael Moore, or whoever you want to say. Like, Hillary Clinton is the one that Donald Trump would have a very real shot of getting the I am not voting for this person vote against.
Right, and for whatever advantages she may have as a candidate, for whatever institutional support that she has, those are all factors that Donald Trump can turn against her in the minds of a lot of the electorate. And you have to think, if the nominee was someone who maybe wasn't as defined in the public eye, you know, both positively as well as negatively, then it may be easier for Trump to tarnish them out of the gates with some label. But equally, they wouldn't have this, you know, 25 years of baggage that Trump is able to exploit. And because, you know, when he talks about crooked Hillary, he's not starting from scratch there, right? Like, he's harnessing something which has been an argument advanced from some quarters for, you know, at least two decades now. And so he doesn't have to put any extra work in to make that stick because it's already stuck to some degree, and he can just continue pushing at that until everyone knows about it and remembers it, even if they might not be inclined to agree with it.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like Hillary really is the embodiment of everything that Trump is rallying the troops against. Political status quo, the people who were born into the system and it all being rigged or whatever. Like, her last name is, she's married to the guy who was already president. Like, it doesn't get any more in the political bed than that. All right. Dom, I guess, as I mentioned earlier, let's go through some of these RNC highlights. I'm sure plenty more on Trump. Let's get to Melania quickly. She was one of the night one speakers. Some controversy came up quickly when it turns out that several of the things that she said were eerily similar to a few of the things that Michelle Obama had said during one of her speeches, I believe in 2008, when Barack was first about to become president. I feel like this can't have been an accident. At least for me, this feels like this has to be on purpose, right? You can't think conceivably that that's going to go unnoticed.
Yeah, this was one of the most frustrating things to see over the past few weeks, because the only people who actually care about this, as far as I can tell, are people who are paid to go on CNN and BuzzFeed and so on and actually pretend to care about a lot of this stuff. And so this is a controversy for political journalists. It's not a controversy for the vast majority of voters out there, including the people who are still in contention, like the swing voters in the swing states.
Oh,
like,
I think plenty of people would care that they blatantly lifted several lines from the possible first lady speech from 8 years ago. Like, that to me is something, if I'm an undecided voter, that would be a strike against that candidate, that they're that lazy.
Right. If it was someone who otherwise hadn't been tarnished yet and who was working to project this image of moral rectitude, but it's not. It's Donald Trump. It's someone who, you know, offends five different groups with something stupid before he has breakfast every morning. Like, this is not someone who cares about being in the good graces of the type of people who would care about this sort of thing. And I think he realizes that, his campaign realizes that. And so when coverage of the campaign is dominated not by Trump, you know, spouting off even more hateful and bigoted stuff, but by some, like, manufactured controversy, essentially, over a speech which, yes, it was blatantly lifted from what Michelle Obama said, but the entire point of these speeches is that they are puff pieces in favor of your candidate. And however inspiring or eloquent an individual speech may be, it serves the same purpose. And I don't think that a lot of people who are watching really take it all that seriously. And so when they hear everyone get bent out of shape over, oh, Trump's wife may have plagiarized a speech, as opposed to Trump himself is just the devil incarnate, that is a win for Trump.
I think maybe you stumbled onto what that is.
Just saying it the whole time.
Well, what I think you may be getting at is, if this is deliberate, it would be with the idea of, we'll put this in, it'll generate a ton of buzz, and the liberal media will completely overreact to it, and it will only strengthen our entire point.
Right. So you compare this to, and when the news about Melania's plagiarism came out, one of the talking points from the Trump campaign was, well, you look at Biden was essentially kicked out of the 1988 primaries because he plagiarized a speech from a British politician who, if you know the politician in question, it's baffling that anyone would want to plagiarize a speech from him, but that's beside the point. But that worked because, firstly, it was a primary process where Biden was trying to introduce himself to the nation and really establish his profile, and having that one incident as one of the things that people knew about him was a lot more damaging than Trump, who has been this kind of bloviating figure in the public eye for the past 40 years or so. And so everyone already has these associations about Trump. The fact that his wife may have lifted some paragraphs from a speech just doesn't even register anymore. Like, it's not the same thing. And the other difference, too, is Biden was meant to be, or was trying to be, like this serious, normal political figure who is operating within the usual parameters. Trump isn't. And so these controversies about the decorum of the Trump campaign just completely miss a point, in my view, because it's really hard in this election to get inside the mind of someone who is still on the fence and undecided, because as people who are adamantly opposed to Trump, you would think that either everyone else would also be adamantly opposed to Trump from the start, or buying into Trump from the very beginning because they like his image, they like the way he approaches things. And so, like, you imagine someone who is like a registered independent who maybe voted for Bush and then Obama or something, who hasn't made their mind up yet, and it's like, what is the tipping point for you? What more do you need to see from Trump in order to deliver a verdict from this guy? Because you've seen all of the offensive things that he said so far, and so the newest scandal or the newest controversy is very unlikely to be the one thing that pushes you over the edge. And so that is almost liberating for Trump in a way, because he now has the freedom to say whatever he wants and appeal to whatever audience he wants, because he knows those people who are going to be offended by him and turned off because of that have already left the table. Like, there's no hope of getting them back. And so he is now targeting a very specific group of voters in specific states and working his appeal towards them. And that's why I worry that I don't think the Clinton campaign has really adjusted to that yet, and it seems like their approach is still look at the latest stupid thing he said, and also here's a bullet point list of reasons why he's unfit to be president, as opposed to really engaging with the way that Trump tries to appeal to people.
Well, I think with the selection of Mike Pence to be his vice presidential running mate, who is a super far right leaning conservative who is now coming out talking about how if Trump wins, hey, we're going to overturn Roe versus Wade. I think that's probably in line with what you're saying, where it seems like they're going for the extremes now, like they're going all in on the, like, for lack of a better term, like the fear mongering vote or the make a big spectacle out of myself, the fight against the establishment vote, where for me, like Trump's speech, one of the longest applause breaks that he got, and it really stood out to me as people were applauding for so long. He was going through the list of, like, vote for me if you want this, vote for me if you want that, and he said, vote for me, like, I'm the candidate for you if you're sick of having to be politically correct all the time. And I think that's really the message that he's trying to send. And I think that's clearly the group of people that he's going for, and that's exactly what Hillary, completely symbolizes, is that the opposite of that message.
Right, and that's the issue as I see it, because you can tell it's not about what Trump is saying exactly. Like, maybe his messages on immigration or trade and so on appeal to certain quarters of the electorate, but it's fundamentally about how he says it and this image that he projects for himself. Because, like, you think about all of the Republican orthodoxies that Trump has trampled over essentially in this campaign. Like, he seems to me to be the least openly religious candidate of any major party in living memory, right?
Like,
right. The only God that he refers to is himself, essentially. And yet that doesn't seem to have hurt him at all. Like, maybe evangelicals are turned off by him, but some of them are still falling into line.
Well, that's what Mike Pence is for. That's what I'm talking about.
Right. And so he's now making these moves to try and reel those people back in. But you think, like, what he said about abortion, he was adamantly pro-choice in public for a long time. And that hasn't just that just washed right over him. And he can now say that he's for abortion, against abortion, whatever, because he is seen as this person who is speaking truth to power, despite the fact that he's just contradicting himself every other week. And so it doesn't matter what he says. It's just the way that he expresses himself is seen to be authentic in a way that it obviously isn't, but in marketing terms, it's hitting every right note for them.
Yeah, I mean, as far as Trump being able to change his mind about whatever he wants, a great Twitter follow, comedian Joe Mondi, who was heavily involved in Parks and Recreation, as soon as Trump, announce that Mike Pence was his running mate or that he would attack Bloomberg or whatever, Joe Mondi would retweet all of these old tweets by Trump calling Pence horrible, or he would retweet Pence himself, because Pence, even just a couple months ago, was in the Cruz camp and tweeting regularly about, oh, Cruz is the guy that we all need to be backing now. And so it's hysterical to see both of these guys, not even within a couple of weeks, going back on it.
Right. Because the thing to me is Trump is trying to change the terms of the argument. And so if you stick to your own terms and insist on debating him point by point on policy, then you have already lost, because that's not the way that Trump is trying to market himself. I think what you need to do to undermine Trump is recognize he is basically like this hyper-masculine power fantasy for some people who, like, they want to see this strong leader. They don't especially care what he thinks. They might not even agree with what he thinks, and that's part of the appeal to them. Like, he is someone who, as they say it, will say what he means, and he's not going to deceive you. He's going to really go to bat for what he thinks. And the way that you engage with him is you try to directly undermine that. Like, you say Trump is a loser. He's a coward. He's someone who, he took all of his daddy's money and he couldn't even avoid going bankrupt with it, right? Like, you frame him in terms that make him not look successful. And because that's, if you read all of the profiles of Trump by people who have worked alongside him, that's this kind of fundamental core of his personality. Like, you read the guy who ghostwrote his book, The Art of the Deal, who has come out, essentially broken the unspoken rule of ghostwriting and just slated Trump publicly because he's so disillusioned by him, who said, like, Trump thinks of everything in terms of success, right? Like, so he can criticize John McCain for getting shot down in war and, like, publicly go against a war hero, which you think would be the kiss of death in a GOP primary. But instead, that almost served Trump even more, because McCain wasn't successful, Trump is successful, and that's the message he wants to hit, regardless of how loosely it actually applies in reality. And so if you can undermine this perception that Trump was successful, then you just kick the legs out from any appeal that he's able to make.
Right. I mean, that's certainly something that we see all the time, is people, when asked why they're voting for Trump, the most common answers are like, oh, he's been a successful businessman, and that's what we need right now. And also, he speaks his mind. And I was thinking, as he was delivering this speech, because he was screaming this entire address for 75 minutes.
Of course.
And I was thinking to myself, why is he screaming? Why is he doing it? And it finally occurred to me, like, because he doesn't want to be coming across as controlled. He's trying to rile people up.
Yeah, if you had a candidate who had Trump's exact policy positions, like if you took a snapshot of them at any moment in time and gave those positions to just a generic, like, Jeb Bush-style candidate, they would be dead in the water because, in terms of their charisma, in terms of their personal appeal, they wouldn't have what it took. And so it would come down to their policies, which are fundamentally inconsistent. But Trump gets to avoid that because those aren't the terms that he's fighting on. And so Trump can define himself in whatever way he wants. And it reminds me of how in 2008, one of the more perceptive things that Obama said about his own campaign, I think, was, I'm like a Rorschach test where everyone can project what they want onto me because I'm selling myself as this avatar of hope and change, and that means different things to different people. If I explicitly try to elaborate on that, then some of those people are going to be turned off. But if I keep it in vague terms, then you can whatever your definition of hope and change is, you can project that onto me and find reason to support me. And I feel like the same thing is going on with Trump, where you could take two people who fundamentally disagree about so many things, but who both of whom are supporting Trump because he is a strong leader. And to them, that outweighs any other consideration.
Well, I also think there's an element of, like, I'm fed up with the way things are going, and clearly so is that guy, and he's going to go do something about it for me.
Right. And it's like I said, for those people, the fact that they don't agree with Trump on everything is almost confirming the appeal of Trump, whereas, like, if he did agree with me on everything, it would almost be too good to be true. But instead, the fact that, you know, we disagree about an important issue and he's willing to say that to me, great, that's exactly the quality that I claim to want in a candidate.
Right. Hey, if he was giving good answers or knew what the hell he was going to do once he got elected, then he would be just another one of those politicians that I hate.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit about someone else who was at this RNC, and that is Ted Cruz, who decidedly did not endorse Trump. Now, Cruz spoke on the second or third night, and apparently Trump entered right as Cruz was, like, culminating with his speech, and which I thought was interesting because Trump later on Twitter, like, the next day said, oh, I knew what he was about to do, and I didn't tell him to stop doing it. And I think it was because he wanted to go and ruin his moment and go and, like, completely steal the spotlight from Ted, right?
Yeah, I was expecting a Jeff Probst-style entrance, like a helicopter landing, just like walking through. And in the middle of Cruz's speech, just walking through the front door, strolling up to the podium, kicking him off. And yeah, I was expecting a lot more grand theater than we actually got out of the campaign, which was kind of disappointing to me. Like, you think back to Obama's first acceptance speech, where he was criticized for having, like, those Greek columns behind him or whatever, when he was standing in the football stadium. I was expecting Trump to take that and dial it up to 20. Like, I was expecting just some, like, grand Roman-style triumph, and instead we got something which was muted by Trump standards.
I assume Trump will only be willing to be sworn in on a gold-plated Bible.
Oh, one that he wrote himself, of course.
A Trump Bible, like, only. The Trump-brand Bible. It's the only one that he's willing to go for.
He would get sworn in on a copy of The Art of the Deal. Like, that's the only way it could possibly happen.
Yeah. Well, going back to Ted, I feel like it's at least conceivable that the only real winner, or I'll put a pin, not the only one, but one of very few potential real winners from this RNC may have been Ted Cruz, who seemed to be in there firmly to plant his flag for 2020 as, I was not on board with Trump when it happened, and you should listen to me now 4 years later because I was the only one who saw clearly at the time.
Do you think that's going to be successful, though? Because if you listen to what everybody was saying when nobody took Trump seriously as a candidate, you had so many of the establishment Republican figures just outspoken in their hatred of Ted Cruz. Like, he is not a popular figure in the Senate or with the party at large. And so the only reason that people ended up rallying behind him reluctantly towards the end was because Trump was the one person conceivably who could be even more despicable than Ted Cruz.
I mean, the man successfully got away with being the Zodiac killer since the 60s, so I feel like he could do something in the White House. No, I do feel like Ted Cruz, if he is going to have a chance in 2020. I don't think it would be by going in there and endorsing Donald. I think he's going in there trying to make a splash. I think this is a guy who clearly wants to be president and clearly feels like he was born to be president and God wants him to be, and it's the right thing for the country. And I think he's doing everything he can. And honestly, I feel like he is, to a certain extent, trying to get the party back on the right track and is essentially betting against them this time, and is banking on them on this not coming in and him looking smart down the line.
And by contrast, I wonder if Marco Rubio maybe had the worst campaign season of anyone, because he's someone who I don't think is a naturally appealing candidate, but he's seen as the front runner, and so it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy where all of the donor money is coming in, and so he becomes even more firmly implanted in that role, and the cycle continues. And so when that gets broken and he's shown to not be successful, there's no reason for anyone to really get in line behind his campaign anymore. And I think it's kind of the same thing you saw with Bobby Jindal, where for a while he was like this rising star within the GOP, and then the moment he was shown to like damage that perception, everything just fell apart instantly because there was no basis underlying that support.
Bobby Jindal was the rising star of the GOP for like 4 days before that fell apart.
Yeah, but like you take the point, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like in like 2006 or whatever, everyone was looking for the next rising star, and so you just like that role fell to anyone who looked even remotely competent. And so, yeah.
Well, I think Rubio and Cruz and probably Paul Ryan fits into this mold. I think a lot of Republicans were probably feeling like on the heels of John McCain and Mitt Romney and losing elections with people like that, those kind of just, as you would imagine, conservative, by-the-book politicians, not overly like exciting or anything, just going to do, you know, vote for the things that they believe in. And I feel like a lot of GOP voters were probably recognizing that that game plan was not working out so well. And I think Cruz and Rubio and Paul Ryan, as I mentioned, probably just felt more like more of the same in that mold. Whereas Trump comes in and just completely smashes things open like a bull in a china shop.
What do you make of the way that Paul Ryan has handled this? Because it seems like he's trying to hedge on both sides, but ending up appealing to nobody, because he's thrown his support behind Trump, right? And he said, okay, I'm not happy about this outcome, but I'm going to make it work. We've got to stand behind the party's nominee. But the people who are drawn to support Trump, they don't like Paul Ryan. Like, Paul Ryan is everything that Trump claims to hate and rally against. And so those people aren't going to be falling behind the Ryan banner in 2020. And then on the establishment side, you're going to have a lot of people, if Trump loses, who will blame figures like Paul Ryan for not speaking out more openly and doing everything they can to make sure it didn't happen.
Yeah, Paul Ryan's in a really interesting spot, because I would first of all probably feel like if I'm Paul Ryan and this Trump experiment doesn't work out, I'm probably not too worried about Ted Cruz. I have some concerns about Marco Rubio, but I would probably feel like I was going to be one of the front runners if I wanted it to be the candidate for president in 2020. And I feel like in the timeline where it doesn't work out for Trump, kind of like what you're saying, the Trump voters don't seem to really like Paul Ryan anyway, or, you know, the Trump hardcore base doesn't seem to like Paul Ryan that much anyway. I think he would probably be far better off doing almost actively distancing himself from Trump. Because I think one of two timelines comes in where either Trump loses or Trump wins, and the GOP is completely almost a brand new party, as far as I can tell.
Here's a dark horse for you. Mittens, third time the charm, going to finally get it together and win in 2020. Because I think there's a parallel that's growing more and more realistic, which is, so Nixon loses in 1960. He runs a lot closer to beating Kennedy than Romney did to beating Obama.
He won the popular vote, I believe. I believe he won the popular vote and lost the Electoral College.
And then in 1964, you see people saying now, like, Trump as a nominee is the first time that I've really feared for the health of the Republic or whatever. People were saying the same things about Goldwater. Like, there were lots of people in the GOP and clearly with the voters as well who just wanted nothing to do with what Goldwater was selling. And then Nixon was able to, like, rise from the dead in the ashes of the party to seize the nomination and then the presidency in 1968. So I wonder if Romney could, if he wanted to, which is not even clear that he does, could kind of go on the same kind of trajectory again.
I think, honestly, Romney would be in fantastic shape here against Hillary. I think he would almost certainly beat Hillary at this point, given the way Trump's doing.
I think he's the one person whose image has gained the most from this entire campaign, because you think back to 2012 when, like, he was mocked by people in his own party as a poor candidate, and you had the Democrats just like tearing him apart over like the 47% comments and binders full of women and so on, which looks positively tame compared to everything that Trump is saying just on every single day right now. And it feels like there's almost this this broad agreement among everyone that we had it not that bad actually when Romney was a nominee. And so maybe it's not Romney himself who ends up filling that role, but someone who is seen as like the heir to Romney, as weird as that would have sounded 4 years ago.
Well, I think that person is Paul Ryan. That's what I mean. I think Paul Ryan is the one who is really poised for 2020. Paul Ryan was his running mate in 2012.
Yeah, but that's my question. Has Paul Ryan boxed himself out of that corner by his like implicit support for Trump, as opposed to Romney, who has explicitly said, I'm not going to endorse Trump, and who is apparently, and maybe this is just rumors leaked to the media, but who is like verged on the edge of endorsing Gary Johnson.
I hadn't heard that, but that's really interesting.
Well, he's like making these overtures. I don't think he's actually going to go through with it, and it would be quite startling if he did, but it's like he is repudiating Trump in the very polite, patrician sort of way that someone like Romney knows how to do things.
Okay, well, to go back to the question, I think that is what I would be advising Paul Ryan should probably be doing, is actively, vocally distancing himself from Trump. Because, as I tried to say earlier, it seems like the two outcomes are either Trump wins, in which case Paul Ryan is now part of a GOP that he doesn't even know anymore, essentially. He's in charge of a GOP that he doesn't even know anymore. Or Trump loses, and I feel like if in that timeline he has distanced himself and made it clear that he was not on board with that in the first place, who's even contending? I mean, I guess it's really early to say, but it seems like he's got to be one of the front runners. And in a situation where, who are the Democrats even going to be running in 2020 if it's not Hillary?
And that's the thing. Like, it could be Tim Kaine, right? Let's say if Hillary wins and then maybe she doesn't want to run again, she isn't able to run for some reason, maybe he steps up. Joe Biden decided not to run this time, but maybe if Hillary isn't in the running, then he would throw his hat back in the ring. There's some talk about like Julian Castro and other people, but yeah, there's no obvious person to take over that mantle yet.
Right. I think, I feel like if Trump wins, 2020 is still totally up in the air one way or the other. I could easily see a scenario where Trump wins the presidency and is not even the Republican nominee in 2020.
That would be, yeah. Well, I can see scenarios where Trump wins the presidency and is not president.
Right. Right. Like, yeah, that's probably what it is. It's because he's been impeached by then.
Right, there is an also a chance that a vote for Trump is actually a vote for Mike Pence.
That's terrible. Like,
which by itself is absolutely terrifying. Like, if you read up on Mike Pence, he is just like he is crazy within normal parameters. Trump is crazy outside the normal parameters. But the fact that those boundaries exist where they are is a sign of just how bad things have got in some places.
Right, I was going to say that Mike Pence sounds almost more terrifying, but even being a complete like Bible thumping, totally against women's rights, whatever. That is still vastly preferable as at least someone who is remotely sane and not going to potentially blow up the world. Like, I know that I tend to be a bit hyperbolic. I have legitimate concerns about if Trump becomes president, that we will witness the end of the world.
It could just be the actual end of days. Yeah, it is certainly non-zero. And because you hear people saying, as I said, Trump is the first person who makes me uniquely fear for what might happen. And that seems kind of weird to me when you had George W. Bush less than a decade ago. But I kind of see where they're coming from, where even Bush was like, you didn't trust him, you didn't like him, you thought he was an idiot, you thought he was incredibly, incredibly dangerous. But Trump almost seems in his own category. Like, he has transcended the normal adjectives that we have to describe people, and is just like in a class of his own.
Here's what I think maybe the ultimate Trump legacy. And I talked earlier about, I don't even remember who I was saying it. Oh, about Ted Cruz potentially being one of the big winners of the RNC. I think maybe the biggest winner of the RNC, if she is interested, especially if her dad loses, could be Ivanka in 2020. Because I think she really, really gained some fans.
Well, so if the Bush surname was enough to dampen Jeb Bush's chances of winning, I think that the Trump name might be even more toxic still. But maybe she could overcome that, because it always struck me, like, watching The Apprentice, watching her public appearances or whatever, you never get a sense of what she thinks about anything or how well she would actually do. But just the way she looks and acts and carries herself, it's like the definition of professional and self-assured, right? So even if she is absolutely batshit insane, which she could be, but we have no idea, then you wouldn't know it just to look at her. And that's vastly different from almost anyone who is putting themselves out there for the GOP in this cycle.
Yeah, I mean, she was careful, by the way, I noticed when watching her speak, to point out, I don't identify as Republican or Democrat. I think she could easily run with either party.
the Democrats are not nominating Ivanka Trump.
I don't know. I think this is contingent upon, well, let me say, I think her having any shot is contingent upon Donald losing this time. I don't think she has any prayer if he actually gets in there.
Right. It's one of those things which is kind of fun to think about in a hypothetical way, but you know that it's not actually going to come to pass.
Well, from what I've heard, she has been like a really driving force behind a lot of his campaign, a lot more than people seem to realize. And also, as you
know, that is terrifying if that's true then, because you see the Trump campaign and the depths that it's gone to. Like, if she is behind that, then she is like some actual mastermind villain who is hiding it behind this very composed corporate facade.
Well, I would be tempted to believe that she is one of the stabler minds behind it. And I'll tell you why, because as you know, Dom, I'm a huge fan of Adam Carolla, who was on The Celebrity Apprentice one season. And he talked openly on his podcast about a lot of the goings on there. And he's, you know, he had plenty of stories about how just batshit insane Donald is. But even back then, he talked about all of those kids. It's like tremendously impressive.
Yeah, I find myself liking Donald Trump Jr., even though I know his father is Satan and therefore he is the spawn of Satan. Somehow he actually seemed vaguely human despite all of that. I don't know.
I think the best thing that could happen for those three kids is their dad losing this election, because I think if he wins, that's the end of the Trump name. Well, ironically, like, it's obviously not the end of the Trump name, but it's the end of it being equated with success.
Right. The thing about Trump is, even if he loses, and we can hope and expect that he's going to lose, I think, what he means for the party, like the fact that he was even nominated by a major political party, and that however many, like 40% of people or even higher, ended up voting for him, that is profoundly concerning, right? Like, for what that represents, even if Trump himself is not going to be getting the nuclear codes at the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. The thing for me, it was like, Dom, I have perfect vision. It would never occur to me that someone would ever require corrective lenses if I didn't see other people, you know, wearing glasses or hear about them wearing contacts or whatever. It would never have crossed my mind for as long as I lived on the planet that someone might require glasses or whatever. The same way that I feel like your current situation as the GOP in the year 2016 is your nominee is Donald Trump and your vice presidential nominee wants to overturn Roe versus Wade in the year 2016. This is where you're at as a party. To me, that doesn't require corrective lenses. I would be terrified right now. But for whatever reason, the same way as I would never, it would never occur to me as having bad vision, the same way it would never occur to me that people wouldn't obviously be concerned about that. But apparently plenty of people are not concerned about that.
So that exact example maybe isn't the best, right? Because as far as I know, there have been lots of candidates on various GOP tickets throughout the years who have explicitly wanted to overturn Roe v. Wade. And I believe didn't the party platform have it in there at some point?
What I'm saying, okay, in the year 2016, even prior to the mid-90s, it was still a slightly defensible issue because there was at least enough backing of the other side. But this is an issue that has been resolved. This is like not on the same level as trying to go back to make slavery legal again, but getting close to that point. We're like, we're getting to the point, the same way with gay marriage, the same way with marijuana, where it's just a matter of time before it's legal everywhere. And abortion is legal. I don't even know if abortion is legal everywhere. There's still plenty of states where
There are lots of states where it is technically legal, but de facto illegal, where there's just no like official support, and they try to crack down on people providing it. But I don't know.
It's legal to get an abortion, but it's also legal to kill abortion doctors. So at your own risk. There you go.
Yeah, you can go out, buy a gun, and just use it to murder an abortion.
Right.
Yeah, but abortion, I think, is going to be a thorny issue for some time just because of what it represents, not just on a religious level, but like you can imagine someone who thinks like abortion is murder, and the natural political consequence of that is I'm going to do everything I can to fight it. Whereas with gay marriage or whatever, it's a lot easier for that to become normalized, I think.
How about stem cell research then instead of abortion? Something similar.
Like you already have Tim Kaine, who a lot of pro-choice groups are angry about because he continues to support the Hyde Amendment, right? So it's an issue which even among like more conservative Democrats is going to be a sticking point. But I see what you mean. Like in the current year, it's strange that a lot of the stuff is still on the table, and there's been a lot of kind of introspection among a lot of people about like these political bubbles that we all insulate ourselves in, it's not even by choice a lot of the time. It's just the people who in age, in demographics, in interest, in just culture in general that you happen to be similar to, you're likely to share their political beliefs too. So So in the Brexit debate, for instance, I think I was the only person with like one or two exceptions that I saw on my entire Facebook feed at any point who supported Brexit. And I imagine for a lot of those people, I was the only person that that was on their feed who was supporting Brexit, and certainly the only person in that kind of age range. And I feel like it's the same kind of thing with Trump, where the Americans I'm friends with, whenever they post anything about Trump, you occasionally see one person who is like ranting about Hillary and says, you know, lock her in jail and I'm going to vote for Trump. But you get the sense that that's one person who like they went to high school with 20 years ago and haven't had the kind of impoliteness to delete from Facebook just yet, as opposed
to just anarchy. Don't worry about it. Don't sweat that.
As opposed to someone who is like a genuine part of their lives. And so there are lots of people who just go through life surrounded by people who agree with them politically about almost everything. And so it's hard to look outside of that and realize there are a lot of people out there who you just never speak to, never realize exist, who fundamentally disagree with you on just on so many things.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up with in high school, a couple of my best friends in high school are still are lifelong and still will continue to be for as long as the party is what it is, which who knows how long that's going to be, but have been lifelong Republicans. I do not believe either of them is even willing to vote for Donald Trump. And these are people who I've been listening for 20 years talk about how horrible Hillary Clinton is for no reason.
Right. And
I'm not saying Hillary is not, I'm not saying there's no reason to pick apart Hillary, but I'm saying they had no reason when they're 10 years old to hate Hillary Clinton. Like,
yeah. Well, it is especially acute in the context of the US as well, where you have a lot of these people on the center left, and just on the left in general, who their only exposure to like any conservative ideas is through the prism of the GOP. So it's through people like Karl Rove and George Bush and now Donald Trump and so on. And it's like you have this entire like section of the political spectrum, which everywhere else in the world, in most places, is more like normalized and well represented, which in the US is just like the party that's meant to represent those ideas is just completely off the reservation in many cases. And if you are like a self-identifying conservative, often a lot of the best advocates for your ideas are people who can articulate those without you having to feel embarrassed about yourselves are Democrats. They're in the so it's like the Democrats have become like this even broader tent than maybe they would want to be if they had their way, just because there's no real opposition in ideological terms.
Well, this is essentially what exists as far as conservative mainstream media in the US. It was, you know, all of Rupert Murdoch and the Fox News empire. And then essentially just Rush Limbaugh and maybe some Howie Carr that people listen to on certain radio frequencies at like lunchtime or whatever. But that's virtually nothing compared to every major network swinging pretty openly liberal. So it really doesn't make for a conducive kind of middle of the road political discussion atmosphere when every single host on every show has a blatant agenda.
Yeah. So the point has been made many times that by wider, certainly European standards and maybe global standards as well, the Democrats are effectively a center-right party in many cases. And like if you compare those to the conservatives here in the UK, obviously you would have disagreements over some stuff, but there are issues like abortion, which in the UK, that's just not an issue. Like there were some bill like 10 years ago or whatever, which moved the limit to 24 weeks or 21 weeks instead of the other one or whatever, but like...
Well, hang on. What magic kind of craziness is going on in this country that it is an issue? Like what made it not an issue in England? Why don't you guys care about abortion?
Well, that's the thing. The fundamental like political cleavages are very different. Whereas if you look, there are some European countries which have this stronger religious tradition as it pertains to politics, like where there is a Catholic party, right, that still is opposed to abortion and wants to ban it, let's say. I think that's the case in Poland, if I'm getting it right, maybe some other places too. Like in the UK, in other places, that's just not really an issue in the same way. But equally, we have our own issues, which just are not issues anywhere else either. And so it's funny because you hear a lot of talk about Americans not being willing to look outside their own borders and it being very like American-centric, right? And that most often gets leveled at the GOP and their natural base of supporters. But I feel like it's kind of the same way in the other direction too, where the entire political climate is unique in a lot of ways. And if you're not willing to recognize that and look outside it, then a lot of the debates that you have look very different.
It sounds to me like essentially in England and in Europe, from what I understand in general, they not only were on board initially with the idea of separation of church and state, they actually went through with that. Whereas for us, certainly not so much the case all the time, where we're on board in theory, but then a lot of people still bring it into it and plays a pretty major role in a lot of policy issues here.
So the example of abortion is kind of interesting. So in the UK, it was legalized in, I believe it was 1967. So in terms of timing, it's actually not that far away from when Roe v. Wade came in 72, 73. But the reaction to that, like when the abortion bill came in, I don't know how much debate there was over here about it, but it became just like part of the law of the land pretty quickly. And then it was just never really talked about again because there was no political or cultural incentive to drag it up and make it an issue. Yeah, the general point I think is well taken, which is the context in which you view political issues and just political events in general is so warped by everything else that is going on that it's hard to like step outside of that and be even somewhat objective about it. And so like we, I think, agree substantively on a lot of stuff, like the policy debates or whatever that might be coming up. At the same time, the way that the routes that we took to get there as it pertains to looking at issues in the US is just so radically different, because I'm doing it as an outsider, you're doing it as someone who is immersed in it and has had to grow up and live with those debates your entire life.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at, Dom, is it feels to me, just as a person in America, like Europe and probably Asia too, just in general, have their shit more together than we do. And this is kind of my whole feelings about the GOP, and what I mean when I say this is where you're at in general, is it feels like where you guys are, and certainly just from what I've seen of South Korea, like on The Genius, it feels like there's a lot of prioritizing family and community and personal accountability, and taking responsibility for things. Whereas in America, it feels like we are prioritizing essentially having our feelings yelled back at us so that we don't feel bad about how things are going for us. Listen, I'm not trying to for the Dharma initiative over here, Dom. But I do want to be focusing on not only personal, but communal accountability, and not who is going to go and yell at people on my behalf.
Well, we all know you're a dirty communist, so don't even try to hide it. Okay. It's pointless.
Yeah, well, let's get on to the other dirty communists, I think. Let's talk about the DNC.
That's what the DNC stands for, right? It's dirty something communist.
Dirty, nasty communists. Yeah. How does England feel about Bill Clinton? Bill was in the building.
He was. I think we pretty much like Bill Clinton, as far as I know. Like he's seen as just, I mean, he is a politician who exists, I guess. You don't really hear that much about him anymore outside of in the context of Hillary, which I guess is a victory in some symbolic sense. But
it's really, I'm actually going to be curious to see, once Obama comes out of office, which of he or Bill ends up being more popular, because Bill at least...
Oh, there's no question about that. It's Obama. There's no... Like, I would gladly bet everything I own and everything I might own in the future on Obama winning that title and holding it in perpetuity, because unless he just like takes a massive heel turn after he leaves office and does something insane, like Bill Clinton, I think, is kind of lumped in with Tony Blair over here, where, and a lot of people don't like Tony Blair, so he gets a lot of the blowback from that. Whereas Obama, still for a lot of people, is just this transcendent messiah figure. Almost.
I think you're right, first of all. But I mean, Bill truly has been, at least prior to Obama's coming of age, I guess, coming of age 50 when he became president or whatever. Bill really was like Elvis for the Democrats. He was far and away the most popular person in the Democratic Party. And I think you're right that Obama is definitely going to be on that level too, if not even higher. What's Bill going to be up to, do you think, if Hillary ends up winning? Is he going to play a role here?
So he's going to be unique, certainly in the context of the West, and I think globally as well, in terms of someone who had that much political power and was in the identical role, now reinstalled as the first spouse, if you like. And it's going to be fun to see how he reimagines that role for himself, because Hillary herself was more involved in policy terms than the vast majority of first ladies were up until that point.
you think about then all of them combined up until that point.
Right. You think about running the healthcare initiative and so on. And so you can imagine Bill being not like a co-equal in those terms, but really wanting to assert his authority. And I think that could actually be like a point of tension in a Hillary Clinton administration of what is Bill Clinton, what is his role going to be? Like, is he going to overstep his boundaries? Is he going to be, like, if he disagrees with Hillary about something, is he going to know to keep that to himself, as opposed to putting his voice out there, which he knows and which Hillary knows and which everyone knows still carries a lot of clout in a lot of circles?
Oh, I'm Totally. I mean, Bill Clinton, I think, has got to be one of the most influential people in the world, probably. Is that unfair in your mind?
No, because I
think he's one of the best politicians in the world. And I don't mean I agree with the most of his policies. I'm saying I think he is the best at being a politician that maybe I've ever seen in my lifetime.
Yeah, I think he has like this intuitive sense for it, and this talent and this charisma that you would be very thankful to have if you were a campaign manager.
Right.
Like that is the exact candidate you would be looking for.
Right. He has, very much like Dan Giesling, the ability to make it seem like he's talking specifically to you at all times.
And certainly in Europe, a lot of the center-left movements throughout the mid to late 90s. So we had Tony Blair and New Labour, and you see it in a lot of the mainland European countries too. They refashioned their entire politics essentially around the model that Bill Clinton put forward, where like this kind of third way triangulation philosophy.
Yeah. So I think that's really interesting. I've been wondering what Bill even wants to be doing as far as how involved he wants to be. I'm sure he's not like wishing Hillary would lose or whatever. I don't think it's going to that extent. But I really wonder if he's dying to get back in there and mix it up for like international policy again, or if he would have been maybe a little bit happier, just kind of like chilling out for the rest of his days after being president. But I'm sure he's happy. I'm sure he's known Hillary for quite a while and is probably happy to see all of this come in. Incidentally, closest thing ever, and probably that we will ever see to the Frank and Claire Underwood, right? Like this kind of power couple. It seems insane that a husband and wife could both be president.
That's the obligatory reference to House of Cards, by the way. Yeah, I think the only other example that comes to mind is the Kirchners, I believe you say, in Argentina. But even that was a very different situation to this, where, yeah, this is just unprecedented as far as I'm aware.
I was doing the math earlier. I was thinking about it. I was born under Ronald Reagan. He was still in office for like 18 months when I was born. But I could live, if Hillary wins this election and wins again in 2020, I could be age 37, and I will have only spent the Obama terms as living my life outside of a Clinton or Bush presidency. Every other point in my life would have had a Clinton or Bush presidency for 29 years.
Yeah, there was some statistic that was like, the last winning Republican ticket that didn't have a Nixon or a Bush on it was 1928, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, because you had 52 with Eisenhower and Nixon, and then they win again, and Nixon wins in 68, and then you just keep tracking it forward, and it's like, you wouldn't think that would be the case, but it actually, it turns out to be true.
Right. Yeah, that's really remarkable. Yeah.
And it kind of goes to confirm just how a small handful of figures just really define the entire history, like the entire political history of the country, and therefore the world in the process. Like, for as much as we talk about the kind of oligarchy that Clinton v. Bush round three might represent, this isn't a new development by any means.
Do you think that that is necessarily a bad thing? And I know that I am asking you this as a person who lives in a country with a monarchy, where you have let the same family be in charge for like hundreds or thousands of years or whatever.
Right, but we only abide by that because they have no actual political power. Like, if the Queen was getting involved in domestic politics, I think a lot of people would sing a very different tune.
Can I ask a question? If everyone feels that
way, you may, Colin. Yes.
Why don't we get rid of the royal family and end world hunger forever?
What kind of bullshit question is that?
It seems like we're investing a ton of money into this thing that everyone understands is not really that meaningful.
Right, but it pays for itself in tourism terms, as far as I know.
Oh, okay.
And it's not that much money. Like, it's not like you could just execute the royal family and then give their entire life savings to the poor of Africa and suddenly the world would be pure again.
Well, that's
not the way it works.
I want to execute the royal family. That's something like, I know you can't say, go kill the president or whatever. Like, that's literally illegal to do that. Except like in the context of explaining that it's illegal.
I believe threatening murder against anyone is illegal, but yeah, carry on.
Is there like a crime, or is there like a steeper punishment for threatening harm against the Queen?
I'm sure there is. It hasn't been invoked as far as I know, and I don't plan to test it to see if there is one.
Yeah.
Probably. I imagine there is.
All right. Well, let's go back to the deal. Let's go back to Bill quickly. Just one other thing on Bill. Did you see Bill with the balloons? This was probably everyone's favorite part of the DNC, is Bill playing with the balloons as they fell around Hillary on Thursday night.
Yeah, did you see that video that was making the rounds from the 1996 DNC of Hillary and a bunch of delegates just singing the Macarena?
Yeah, that was really, really strong stuff.
I watched that on loop for hours. It is captivating, especially the way that you could tell Hillary's like, I have no idea what the hell is going on, but I'm just going to roll with it because why not? And it's like this, she almost pulls it off very convincingly. The whole dancing motion and everything is exactly what her handlers would have told her to do. Well, it's very impressive.
The great thing about that is they're cutting to all the people in the crowd doing the Macarena along with the thing, but Hillary is just clapping along with it, not even attempting the actual Macarena dance, and she's like staring into the camera really creepily. It's great. It's fantastic stuff.
She knows the limits of her own self-expression, right? She knows if she tries to actually go along with the dancing, it's all going to end in disaster. So she just takes a safe option, much like she did with Tim Kaine, much like she does in general, and just, you know, it's very symbolic of the whole Clinton ideology.
Yeah, well, I mean, going back to the idea of that, you know, this husband and wife potentially both becoming president, I think this goes back to kind of what I was saying earlier about Trump being the candidate for, oh, I'm against the way that this establishment has been running for all these years in this rigged system. As I said, what more evidence could it seemingly look like that this is rigged in someone's favor than this is the wife of someone who was already president?
Right. I can imagine Trump trying to make himself like emperor for life or something, the way Julius Caesar did, or like the way Kim Il-sung did in North Korea, just like erecting a giant statue of himself in every city center, mandating that every house needs to have a giant portrait of Trump that gets regularly dusted and inspected and so on. Like, we could see Trump push the boundaries of executive privilege to a whole new level.
Well, kind of going back to that, I mean, I don't think anyone even thought we were joking about this, and if they did, they were wrong, because I am certainly at least not joking about the notion that if Trump does become president, the world could potentially end during that time. And one of my main concerns about Trump is, because, you know, this is the story of how he ended up filing for bankruptcy like four or five times, is he would have a bunch of work done and then file for bankruptcy so that he wouldn't have to pay to get it done, but he would personally make a bunch of money there. And I feel like we're essentially setting ourselves up to let him do exactly that with the entire country. And I thought it was really interesting where, as he was trying to rally voters around him, essentially on all these like extraordinarily xenophobic principles, he read this story to the crowd as he was campaigning about a woman who took in a snake and nursed it back to health, and then the snake bit her and killed her, and the snake said, hey, you knew I was a snake when you took me in. And he was using that story to illustrate like, oh, we shouldn't be taking in these Muslim people. To me, I was like, dude, you're warning us about you. Like, this is exactly, yeah, we know that we've watched you do this so many times. Why would we possibly expect you to act in any way other than the benefit of your shareholders?
Right. It's because what's weird to me is you have a lot of people who either just always vote Republican or whatever, and that's their party, so that's what they do. And then more people who are drawn to Trump's essentially white supremacist message or whatever else. But then you also have some typically very smart people who find rationalizations for voting for Trump on the basis that he's going to upend a corrupt political system or do whatever. And it's like, I don't think voting for Trump by itself makes you racist or whatever. I think voting for Trump, you have to be okay with what he is saying, and you have to think whatever the potential benefit is outweighs the stuff that you know he is going to visit among a lot of the most vulnerable people in society, and you have to be on some level okay with that or think that that trade-off is worth it. And like, if you have some reason like, oh, Trump is not going to take his orders from big business, or Trump's going to stand up to the establishment, none of those other reasons stand up to scrutiny, I think. Like, if you do buy into Trump's racism or something, you can vote for Trump without any concerns at all. But if you're voting for Trump because for some other reason, there's no reason to think that he can actually deliver on that. Firstly, because he just contradicts himself with every other breath. But also, let's say you're one of these Bernie Sanders supporters who hates the establishment and thinks that Trump is the best way of overturning that. Well, to fight against the establishment, you have to know how the establishment operates, what they think, and what the best way to fight them is. Trump, in political terms, literally knows nothing. He doesn't know what they think about any of these issues. He doesn't know how they operate. He doesn't know what to do to combat those. And so he will be a prime target for someone in the establishment to kind of adopt and fashion into their own person, essentially, the way that like Cheney was accused of doing with George W. Bush. And so like this idea that Trump is going to be this revolutionary who's going to suddenly stand up for the interests of the common man is just, I think it's just absurd on the face of it, but also it's not supported by anything that he said or done.
Yeah, I really struggle to understand even how people think that that's going to work when he doesn't even pretend to have any ideas about what he's going to be doing once he's actually potentially elected, right? Like, he spoke for 75 minutes at the RNC and offered zero in the way of actual what we're going to do as far as making these messages that I'm screaming at you actually come to life.
Right. The hope is that just via the sheer force of his personality, he can just bulldoze through any obstacles that might stand in his way. But like the political operatives that he would have to deal with, including like leaders of foreign countries, like Angela Merkel, for instance, is no pushover. Vladimir Putin, who he's trying to get in bed with, is a very formidable figure. Like all of these people, they might not recognize Trump, they might not have had to deal with anyone like him before, but they're not going to just like lie down and let him roll over them. They are going to push back, and he's not going to know what to do when that happens, because he's used to being in this position where, by his own admission, he can either just fight anyone who's in his way, or he can just pay off anyone who's in his way and move on regardless. And that's not the way it works when you're trying to run an entire country.
Who do you think Putin is rooting for to win this presidency? I think it's got to be Trump, right? There's no way he wants it to be Hillary.
Well, so someone made a good case on Twitter, which is, if Putin wants Trump to win, why would he voice that fact? Like, he knows that can only go down badly. So what would be the political benefit of doing that? Unless he is so out of touch about the way that he is perceived that he thinks he's some, like, he's like being rooted for from afar by the core American voter or whatever. Like, why would he do that?
No, I don't mean at all that I think he should endorse anyone. I'm just saying, when he's sitting in his palace plotting his next step in dominating the world, who would he rather see as the president of the U.S.? I think the answer is clearly Donald Trump. I don't think he can expect relentless resistance from Hillary basically across the board. And I think Trump, he's probably views as a moron.
What did you make of this whole controversy that came up over firstly Trump's comments about Putin, but then also like this whole thing about Russia hacking into the DNC emails or whatever to... Like, what was your whole take on that as someone who saw it kind of play out firsthand?
Didn't Trump say do it more, like keep doing it or something along those lines?
Yeah, and then he was criticized for like inviting Putin to meddle in a domestic election, which, first of all, the idea of the US foreign policy establishment being shocked and appalled that a foreign government might try to interfere in an election is so just like it's so hypocritical that it doesn't even bear talking about. But it's weird to see how politically the idea of Russia as this boogeyman has kind of reversed polarity, if you like, where you have Trump almost implicitly endorsing him because of he shares that kind of strongman image and mentality. And then you have the Democrats kind of invoking that as this outside threat that we need to be worried about. And if you think about it, like you have people who wrote off the Hillary email scandal as just this contrived thing by the media, now expressing like this newfound concern about information security, and who like they mocked Romney in 2012 for speaking about Russia as a prominent geopolitical foe still, and they warned for a long time about scaremongering during the Cold War. Now they are the ones who are losing their minds over Russia as this external threat. And then on the other side, you have the Republicans, who got so much political mileage out of milking the threat of the Cold War for years and years and years, who now seem to be perfectly fine with Russia. They're not talking about Reds under the bed anymore or whatever. They're just fully embracing the Russian state for what it is, which is bizarre to watch.
Yeah, at least for me, I don't follow Russian politics, like domestic politics there closely at all, but I do regard, and maybe unfairly, Vladimir Putin as someone that I'm slightly concerned about, as far as I'm not really sure the checks and balances are all necessarily there to keep that guy in line if potentially he gets some ideas. And my big concern when it comes to Russia is just the possibility, whether they're in bed at first or not, they could start off as best friends. I really don't know how long Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin are going to stay cool with each other. To me, that seems like we're almost along the lines of like putting Boston Rob and Russell on the same villain's beach. Like, it almost feels like just a matter of time.
Yeah, not only is Donald Trump actively belligerent just in the way that he conducts himself, but even if he's trying to kind of toe the line, which would be a new development for him, he might cause a major diplomatic incident just by accident, just by being who he is and acting the way he does. And it's kind of scary to think that, yeah, maybe if it was with another Western democracy or whatever, then the worst that would be caused is some political damage and some offense or whatever. But if it's with Putin or China or whatever, then the consequences could be catastrophic.
Right.
And for as horrifically damaging as George Bush was, and for as weird as it is to say that Trump is the first time that people are really scared about things, I think Trump has more destructive capacity than George Bush ever did, and that's a scary thought.
I mean, not only George, I assume you're talking about George W., not George H.W., but
yeah.
not just George W., I mean, I think a lot of people viewed him as like a Chang Yat puppet president, Don, but I think even with Dick Cheney involved in that too, I would gladly take George W. and Cheney back in the Oval Office over Trump right now, without question.
That's my actual dark horse of 2020, by the way. George Bush Sr. for president. Just exhume him, get him back up from wherever he's living at the moment, and just force him back in the ring again.
I think he's down in Maine. I think he's or here in Maine, I should say. He's down south in Kennebunkport, I believe. It's the summer. I think they're both there. They may not be. I don't know. I haven't talked to them lately. I'll give them a call tomorrow and find out.
It's weird as well. Like I go on Reddit sometimes, and I'm not sure why I ever do, because it never ends well for me. But you go into these threads and you see people saying, you know what? I disagree with George Bush, and I wouldn't have voted for him, and I disagree with Iraq, but he seemed like a nice guy, you know, someone you would like to just have a beer with.
Right.
And that's in stark contrast to this obscene oaf in Donald Trump. And it's like, firstly, he's a politician. The whole point is to appeal to people in a way that might not seem, in a way that makes it seem natural. But secondly, like, how do you forget all the damage he did, and also all of the arguments that people like you, including probably you yourself, were making in the early 2000s about what a terrible president he was? Like, the fact that that we're now less than a decade removed doesn't erase all of that damage, and it doesn't suddenly make him a nice person. And there are so many nice people out there who don't run for the most important office in the world and who make a pig's ear out of it. So it's such a weird, like, reversal to see from people.
Well, I think I believe I recently heard that he said somewhere, or someone, it got put out there somewhere, that he voiced the concern that he could potentially be the last Republican president that we ever end up having. And I think, honestly, he would have to not look too far to figure out who to blame, where I think, as you referenced, it was literally in the year 2000, it was that catchphrase. It was, who would you rather have a beer with? That's who Karl Rove made the entire fucking campaign about. Like, if Al Gore looked like he could be fun at all in a bar, he would have gotten 65% of the vote. But that's literally, George W. won multiple elections, or I guess the first one on looking like he'd be fun to have a beer with, and the second one on, well, now we're pot committed to this war, how could we possibly change now?
Well, he was declared as the winner in multiple elections on those grounds. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. He technically won, I suppose, if we're not counting all the ballots Jeb hid down there in Florida. But anyway, let's go back to the DNC. Someone you brought up, Dom, that being Bernie Sanders. Bernie was in the building. My sister was actually there that night. She got to see Bill talk, and she got to see Bernie as they were going through the state's roll call. Vermont ended up going last, and Bernie gave Hillary, like, whatever, like, officially nominated her or conceded or whatever to make it official. And that was apparently a huge, huge moment in the room.
So what's the actual process for that, by the way? Did she have to apply in advance? Did she just get to walk in? Is it like buying tickets for Hamilton, where you pay like $1,000 and then 2 months later you get the one night that's open or whatever? Like, how does it work?
No, my older half-brother is coincidentally in Vermont, as well as Bernie, heavily involved in the Democratic Party, and got her, like, texted one of his friends who was there and said, hey, can we get her some credentials? And that was it. She just happened to be in Philly anyway. She didn't go for that. She wasn't a delegate.
So you're saying it's classic Clinton-style nepotism.
That's exactly right. I mean, we wouldn't have it any other way. Yeah. She and I are both going to be president, by the way. That's the plan.
Well, wonderful. Hopefully it's her first. We can delay the apocalypse for 8 years or so. But so what's your take been? I've been very interested to ask you about this, and we've chatted about it a bit off air, but what's your take been on the whole Bernie Sanders campaign? Are you a Bernie bro? Were you four-square behind him, and now you're reluctantly coming in line behind Hillary? Or what was your whole stance on things?
I was, when it was very much... I don't think it was ever, honestly, in retrospect, very much up in the air between the two of them. Not only because of the inside track, I think we saw that Hillary had with that, as you mentioned, that email scandal, that email hack getting released. It really did seem like Bernie was fighting a very much an uphill battle there. I was honestly really, really impressed by the Bernie campaign for a very long time. And I would have been absolutely thrilled to see Bernie actually end up getting the nomination instead. I don't think he has nearly the kind of, like, political knowledge or, like, policy background that Hillary does. I think he would probably know less about what he was actually doing in there. But I think Bernie is, you know, the Bernie campaign was a fantastic sign of the times. The same way that I would say having someone up there as a vice president saying we should repeal Roe versus Wade in the year 2016 is the opposite of what I think Bernie was talking about trying to fix things in the correct direction. I do think at the end of the day, it was almost hopeless. And now I think we're past the point of, I'm almost at the point, I guess, where I wish it had never been a thing, because I am really, really, really fearful about these Bernie or bust people potentially swinging it.
In what way?
For Trump, where there seems to still be a solid contingent of people, and they were even at the DNC, who would, as Hillary was speaking, start chanting, Bernie, Bernie, Bernie. I feel like there are, and I say this because plenty of them are Facebook friends of mine, who are just unwilling to vote for Hillary because they have such sore bottoms that Bernie didn't end up getting the nomination. And the fact that it's Donald Trump who would get the nomination or who would get the presidency instead plays zero role for them. And to me, that is the part I would like to focus on. And I do not want to shame those people and say you shouldn't like Bernie or you shouldn't feel bad that he lost. What I would say to those people is we need to focus on what is realistically going to happen. And what is realistically going to happen is either Hillary or Trump is going to be president. And Trump becoming president would be beyond a disaster unlike anything this country has ever seen. Essentially, what I think would be good is at this point, and I wish he had done, you know, been able to do this at the election or at the DNC. I think Bernie, whether or not it's even close, I think right now he needs to start coming out and saying, look, we need to start focusing on other things. I'm 74 years old or whatever. I am not going to become president. We cannot let Donald Trump in. I think he needs to be the opposite of Ralph Nader. I think he needs to be doing everything he can to make sure that no votes go the way that they're not supposed to.
Okay. I'm glad you brought up Ralph Nader because I have a rant to go on here because I think it's one of the enduring myths of the last kind of two decades of politics. And it's something which I think is affecting political discourse now and will do for a long time. Like, I guarantee you, in the 2076 election cycle, there are going to be people saying, well, you have to fall in line behind the candidate because we don't want to end up with another Ralph Nader situation. The thing is, it's like that argument only gets made against Ralph Nader. Firstly, it's incredibly results oriented, right? Like, Nader ran in other elections. There are other factors at play in that election. No one ever says, oh, well, the Nader voters in California or whatever are to blame for Bush winning. They're saying it's the Nader voters in Florida who are uniquely to blame for giving us 8 years of George W. Bush. They always blame Nader. They never blame, let's say, Jeb Bush and Katherine Harris and the entire state machinery of Florida that was captured by the Republicans and employed on behalf of George Bush. They never blame the election logistics that were set up with the hanging chads debacle and so on. They never blame the Supreme Court, which essentially handed the election to Bush and then declared that wasn't actually binding precedent at all and it was only a one-off situation. They never blame any of the institutional factors like that. And if you're going to blame the voters, the margin that Gore lost by was just over 500 votes. In a state of 6 million people, you could take any subset of voters and find 600 people who could have gone either way. So again, they blame Nader. They don't blame the almost 2,000 people who voted for an actual communist party in Florida. They don't blame the hundreds of people who voted for various socialist parties. They especially don't blame the more than 300,000 Democrats, who registered Democrats who either voted for Bush and the many more registered Democrats who just didn't show up to vote at all. Instead, it's meant to be the 25,000 Nader voters who are uniquely to blame for bringing this down upon us. They never even blame Gore for just being a bad candidate who ran a bad election campaign and then who also subsequently ran a bad recount campaign. They ignore every single other pertinent factor and just bring it back home to these Nader voters who mathematically had very little role to play in the election whatsoever. It's like, to me, blaming Nader for that result, it's like the people who answered your Twitter poll saying it matters which order you draw the rock in. Like, it has no basis in reality whatsoever.
Well, I'm looking at the numbers of the 2000 election right now. George W. got 47.9% of the popular vote and won by 5 points five votes in the Electoral College. Al Gore got 48.4% of the vote, which means Nader got 1.6 plus 2, 3.7% of the vote, which, when we're only looking to swing 5 Electoral College votes, you don't think 3.7% of the vote in one state could have done that? Like, I think What the argument is none of the things that you just listed, yes, you're right, but all of those only would happen if Nader stays in and makes it an issue. If he just doesn't go in, it's Al Gore and it's over.
Right, and if none of those other things I mentioned happened either, then no one would be blaming Nader because there wouldn't be an issue to be had.
But now, why would Nader has literally zero chance of making any impact other than costing Al Gore the election. Why do that? Why? I think the question is, why even go into the race when you have absolutely no shot of winning? And why run the risk of impacting things?
Why should Bernie Sanders enter the primary, given that he has basically no chance of winning? Like, why should anyone except the already preordained candidate run in an election, given that they're not going to win? Like, there's no place that you get to stop with that argument.
There is a huge, huge difference between Bernie Sanders running a year ahead of time against one person for a party nomination, a person who potentially was on her way to being indicted, might I add, versus Ralph Nader running when he has no chance of getting one state.
But so what? Why not blame the registered Democrats who voted for Bush, who in every single state were more numerous than the Nader voters?
Why not blame them? Because they wouldn't have had to do that if Nader hadn't been in there.
Well, what do you mean they wouldn't have had to do that? They
voted for
Bush. It
wouldn't have made a difference, I guess, is what I'm saying. Like, their ineptitude wouldn't have made a difference if Nader had just made... Why are we talking about this?
It would have made a difference. It would have made a difference in Florida, where 300,000 of them, which is three times as many people as voted for Nader in totality in that state, voted for Bush. Like, they not only did they not vote for your candidate, they actively voted for the opponent, and yet they escape all of the criticism. And it's the people who were, you know, voting for Nader who didn't sell out early enough who apparently are to blame for all of this. Like, and I bring this up because this is the argument that always gets made. It's only ever employed as a cudgel to beat the people who are further to the left or right than the mainstream people who control the party.
Let me walk you through how Maine ended up for the last 8 years with the worst governor in the country. Not even up for debate. We have the worst governor in the country. We have two of the best senators, worst governor easily, because both times it was a split vote where in 2010, he wins the governorship, Republican Paul LePage wins governor with 38% of the vote because Democrat Libby Mitchell refuses to step down and concede. So independent Elliot Cutler, who would have easily smashed LePage, they end up splitting 61% of the vote. LePage wins. He runs for re-election the next time. Now Mike Michaud is the Democrat who's going to run away with it, except Elliot Cutler now won't step down. The same guy who had it taken away from him the first time now costs the Democrat the second time, essentially like paying them back. And Paul LePage now gets two terms. What I'm saying, there are absolutely cases where that's a valid thing. Where, like, if this third party weren't involved, this of course would have gone the other way.
Right, but how are those two groups of people who supported different candidates meant to unite behind one of them? And which one are they meant to align behind? So which one of them would you have supported?
They're meant to align behind the one that is still in the race when the one that is obviously losing backs out to make it clear so that the disaster result doesn't happen.
This framing implies that, so for instance, Al Gore was entitled to the votes of the Nader people, and he shouldn't have had to put any effort into earn them just because he was better than whoever the opponent happened to be.
I'm not saying he was entitled to them. I'm saying if Nader were not there, in virtually all likelihood, the vast majority would have gone to Al Gore, yes? Is that not fair in your mind to say?
There was research about that where they asked Nader voters, and it was like 40% go to Gore, 27% goes to Bush, which makes no sense, by the way, but apparently that's how they would have gone. This argument only ever gets employed in this exact scenario to blame people like the Nader voters, even when they're like number 15 on the list of reasons why Gore lost, and much higher than that is him just being a bad candidate. Like, if he puts some basic effort into the election, right, and he wins his home state, let's say, if he wins one more state and just doesn't act like an idiot, then the fact that 400 people voted for Nader in Florida just doesn't make a difference whatsoever. And we would not be having this argument now. Nobody would be having this argument now. And yet instead, because like you drew the one in a million shot where all of these things conspired to make those handful of votes matter, even though they didn't mathematically, somehow now Nader is a villain in this whole scenario when it just doesn't make any sense.
All right, well, it's staggering that apparently 400 people in Florida would have even rather had a beer with Ralph Nader than Al Gore. Nader is the most boring guy that has ever existed. Is that a fair statement?
He's almost like interestingly boring, right? You want to poke behind the visage and see what's actually beneath it.
Yeah.
But this plays back into a wider argument where you see, and I think it is right to account in some way for the fact that Trump is a historically bad candidate. Like, even George W. Bush at his worst, even whoever you think was the most despicable candidate before that, like, Trump is in a league of his own, and that should factor into your model for voting somehow. But you see this all the time where people say a third party vote is a wasted vote, and to me that's just complete nonsense. Like, there are two ways you can look at it. I think you can say either, and this is just obviously statistically true as far as I'm concerned, your vote mathematically is insignificant. Like, it doesn't make any difference. The chance that you actually have any impact over the election is infinitesimally small. And given that, you should vote for the candidate who best shares your views as a personal statement. And that's the only reason to cast your vote in that case. Or you can say, well, my vote does matter. And so in that case, my vote is the only leverage I have. And if in every single election for the rest of time, you're going to be squandering your control over that vote because, you know, the Republican candidate clearly is worse than the Democratic candidate, so I have to vote for the Democrat, then you lose any measure of control that you have over people's need to appeal to you. Because if your vote is locked in for Hillary this time, and then whoever the Democrat is next time, and then and so on and so forth for the next 60 years, then the Democrat candidate, whoever that happens to be, has no reason to adjust their positions or adjust their appeal to go after you. They're going to go after the people whose votes might actually change, and those are going to be the people on the center right, who might actually consider voting for the Republican candidate. And so you're always going to end up with a more moderate candidate who doesn't share your views and is going to have to tack to the right in order to get elected. Whereas if your vote might actually change, then that's something that they have to factor in and appeal to.
So say we have a scenario. Let's just play out. We have one timeline and then we have an alternate timeline. I'll say optimistic here. Hillary's going to go on to win this election. Had we gone down the alternate timeline where Bernie did decide to run as like a third party candidate, and that would have almost surely cost Hillary the election, is it not fair to point and say Bernie should not have done that? That is clearly what cost Hillary the election.
Why didn't Hillary drop out and support Sanders? And that can be like the one candidate from this side. Like, as I said, that argument only gets made to force the non-mainstream person out of the race.
What I'm saying is, I feel like when you are presented with a situation where your immediate future is at, you know, hangs in the balance, if this was a survivor situation, we would be berating the hell out of it. Okay, Jonathan Penner doesn't get the memo, votes out Abby, and instead his Jeff Kent ends up leaving because he was just on the wrong side. Or did we not berate Jonathan Penner that week?
Right, and that's one vote out of 10 instead of one vote out of 100 million or whatever. Like, obviously that logic breaks down when you have a very small number of people, but this is the exact opposite of that. This is a case where your one vote, like, it is not worth the time that you would take going down to the polling station if it was next door to you. Like, it would just... Yeah,
I agree. I virtually never vote. My one vote will essentially makes absolutely no difference. But I guess what I'm sensing is that you are arguing similarly. It sounds to me like the way that you argued for leaving during Brexit is I don't like the uncertainty of not knowing. You know, the same way that I would put my vote on a third party candidate, because if I just keep falling in line, then this majority party that I'm backing has no incentive to actually look out for me. In this case, that being the European Union for Brexit. I just feel like a lot more people, and rightfully so, when Donald Trump becoming president is the disaster outcome that is very possible, are going to be focused on this exact vote and not worried about the, 60 years from now, my party's not going to have incentive to like me or whatever. I think they're correctly going to be focused on, we need to keep Donald Trump out of the White House.
Right, but I'm saying in this case, like in the current year, in 2016, that argument is being deployed and it's focusing on the fact that Trump is so uniquely disastrously bad or has the potential to be. But that argument is going to get made again in the future. So in 4 years' time, like, name the Democratic candidate that you would least like to support, just as an exercise.
Well, before I do that, can we go back and kind of, because I would say George W. was very much the political atmosphere felt the same with George W. about, we're going either the environmentally conscious Al Gore route or we're going the Wild West George W. route. And there, it did feel like plenty was at stake.
Right, but I'm saying, like, let's say, so 2020, it's generic, unliked Democrat versus a relatively palatable Republican. So let's John Huntsman, let's say, just sure. as an example. Right. So let's say it's Huntsman versus X, and it looks to be pretty close. That argument is going to get trotted out again. And the argument is going to be the Democrat, whoever it happens to be, is closer to your values than Huntsman is. And therefore, you should all fall in line behind the Democrat to avoid the risk of our party losing the White House. And that argument is always going to be true, especially as the GOP kind of continues on this race to the bottom, where they reach the bottom and they just kick through it and keep going down and down even further, where maybe next time it's going to be Cruz or Rubio or Paul Ryan. And like, that argument is always going to be true. And so if you just lock in your vote in perpetuity for whoever the Democrat happens to be, then you lose any slight measure of control that you once had. And so I don't think that's a viable political strategy long term.
Well, I feel like, again, just to go back to make it a case-specific thing, I would be terrified of Ted Cruz becoming president of the United States. Yeah. But that would be a one compared to how terrified I am of Donald Trump. I'm fearful that I won't live to be 35 if Donald Trump becomes president.
Yeah, and that's the second point, I think. It's the argument that Donald Trump is so uniquely bad. He is so far off the meter that however you factor him into your model, it just overrides any other concern. Just the absolute need to stop him, however you feel about Hillary Clinton.
Exactly. I mean, he is completely unhinged, as far as I can tell. That is exactly right. That's all that matters. And that's why I'm saying Bernie, I feel, would be doing his legacy and the world a great service and coming out and saying, hey, disgruntled Bernie bros, I know we fought really hard. We did everything we could. We have to look out for the greater good. That is the core of our message the entire time. We must be doing what is best for everyone. And that has to be keeping Donald Trump out.
He basically did say that, right?
No, he did say that more or less. But I think he needs to, if it continues to look like the case that there are people putting up a huge resistance to voting for Hillary because they are butthurt about Bernie not getting the nomination, I think he would be wise to do everything, like, for his own personal future safety, like not wanting Donald Trump to be president, and also just for his political career. I think he could potentially be viewed, like I said, as like the anti-Ralph Nader, as the person that we're talking about Bernie swung at Hillary's direction because he was able to convince all those people or whatever. Like, he was the deciding person. I think he's smart. By the way, pretty smart not to make him the vice president, because it would not take long for some Bernie bro to assassinate Hillary and feel like a total hero if Bernie was the vice president.
All I'm saying is, okay, so I get that the argument has more traction in this cycle than it would normally just because of how bad Donald Trump is. But we already saw with Nader this exact case where, like, this argument gets trotted out even when it makes no logical or mathematical sense, and it will continue to be in the future in the service of marginalizing candidates who the establishment never supported in the first place.
I disagree that the Nader argument makes no difference. I think it makes a ton of difference, so...
Well, then you are saying that you wanted to be the first to draw the rock out of the bag because that changes your odds. Like, it's just not supported by reality in any way.
Let me read to you the very end. I went to the 2000 election Wikipedia. The Green Party gained widespread public attention during the 2000 presidential election when the ticket composed of Ralph Nader and Winona LaDuke won 2.7% of the popular vote. Nader was vilified by some Democrats who accused him of spoiling the election for Al Gore. Nader's impact on the 2000 election has remained controversial, Dom. No one knows for sure.
Well, yeah, the fact that people made that argument is... How is that meant to convince me? I know they make that argument, and they're wrong, because the argument doesn't make any sense. Like, I don't know what you want me to say.
All right, fine. I don't know. I feel like, to go back to the larger point, I think there is still plenty of work to be done with possible Hillary votes out there that Bernie could potentially sway, and I think he would be very wise to do so.
So let's take a different tack then. So to you, is obviously voting for Trump is just beyond the pale, but is abstaining on the grounds that I can't bring myself to vote for Hillary, like, in a vacuum, regardless of the fact that there's this even greater terror looming out there, is that morally different to you than just like voting for Hillary because she's a lesser of two evils and I'm going to suck it up and do it?
I mean, as I said, I don't tend to vote virtually ever.
So it's your problem then. You are one of these people who is contributing to, like, if Donald Trump gets in, we can all blame you because you're your laziness has contributed to his rise in success.
No, I will be enthusiastically voting for Hillary this time, and I'll tell you why, which is because Maine, and I think Nebraska is the only other state that's like this. I want to say it's Nebraska. We only have 4 electoral college votes here, but we are actually able to split them. We can go 3-1 or 2-2 or 4-0. So if Trump gets 25% of the vote here, he'll get one of our electoral college votes, and I don't want that to happen.
Yeah, there is this technique which I've seen people use of, there are like these vote trading websites where, like, let's say you are you're a Jill Stein supporter or someone who doesn't really like Hillary in a swing state, you can switch your vote with a Hillary diehard in a locked up state so that their vote actually counts and your vote, which is now being cast by them, still gets to be registered, which I think is a smart idea. It's also an idea which was tried in the 2000 campaign, by the way, and had to be shut down by legal action from the Republican campaign, which denied Gore a lot more than 500 votes, I would say, but let's not rehash that all over.
Yeah. Do they do that in England? It seems like in England that'd be way more effective, where they have so many more parties where you can win with a much smaller percentage.
There is a lot of tactical voting. So you had a lot of seats, it was, let's say I'm a Labour voter. Labour can't win here, but the Lib Dems can, and I want to keep the Conservatives out, so I'm going to vote Lib Dem to make sure that doesn't happen, which it makes a bit more sense on that scale, I think, when like all the constituencies are much smaller and so on. But even in that case, I think, like, if the argument is Labour can't win here, well, there's a reason for that, and the reason is because people don't vote for them. And if you, as one of these supporters, contribute to that, then there's just no hope of that ever changing. So, also, and this is the last point I'll make on the issue, because the debate's dragging on quite long now, but, like, if you wanted to vote Trump, the way to have your vote matter in the biggest way was to register as a Republican and vote in the Republican primary, which none of these people saying that you have to rally behind Hillary now in order to stop Trump ever considered doing. So, like, that is the way to have your vote count. And, like, it's telling to me that none of them were willing to kind of bite the bullet and go through with that, which is what they're suggesting that other candidates' supporters do now.
You're advocating that Democrats go register Republican and then go vote in those caucuses to get non-Trump candidates to be the candidate?
Yeah, why not?
That sounds to you like something that, hey, why wouldn't people just naturally think of that and do that en masse? Why wouldn't everyone do that in towns across America?
I'm saying, if you're urging people to put their principles and so on aside and vote for a candidate who they dislike. And by the way, this is predicated on the assumption that you are one of these disgruntled Bernie people or whatever. Like, if you genuinely support Hillary, then great, you can go out and vote for her and feel happy about that, and that's fine. But if you are in this position, then, like, that seems to be the logical thing to do. And now you're being told by the Clinton campaign, you have to kind of drag yourself out there and vote for the greater good, when there are other measures you can do to do that, and no one ever considered doing them.
I don't believe, I may be wrong about this, but I'd be pretty surprised. I don't think you can, in the same election cycle, like, if you're a Bernie person who wants to go influence the GOP, go register Republican, but then you can't participate in the Democratic one.
Right. It's like, it's not, obviously not going to apply if both of the primaries in your states are closed primaries, let's say. So it's not going to apply to everybody. But this is an idea that was on the table for some people and just never gets thrown out there into the ether.
Because that's way too much work. That's way more work than anyone's putting into doing gaming an election.
Well, apparently it's too much work for some people to just go out there and vote for Gore or vote for Clinton or whoever. So, but anyway, let's leave that aside and move on to something
else. Well, one closing point that I wanted to make about Bernie, because I think he actually weirdly ties in with Trump well this election, where they really both came out of nowhere. And obviously Trump managed to take it a little bit further than Bernie did. But it really seems like they both got virtually all of their mileage out of being people who are, like, perceived as standing up for what they truly believe in and not giving in to the corporate, political, the status quo and all of the shady behind the scenes figures that have been running things for centuries or whatever, that they were the people who are actually fighting for the little guy and standing up for what they believe in. I really think that's interesting, because we kind of hit on earlier, this is coming off of, I guess you have, like, Obama and Clinton being pretty personable on the Democratic side, but at least for the Republicans, they'd gone through that stretch with now Cruz and Rubio, but also before with Mitt and John McCain and people like Jeb, people along those lines, that were just kind of boring and seemed to just be playing the political game. I thought it was really interesting how on both sides this year, the even being a flawed person who just is being honest was more than enough for, at least in Trump's case, and did plenty for Bernie.
How could you forget Bob Dole, Colin? I mean, come on. It's, clearly should have been included on that list. But yeah, the point is well taken that it's obviously being deployed in very different ways, but the basic argument is the same, which is the system is corrupt and so on. And this is just a trope that we've seen established now and be used pretty much every single time. But it's interesting that the way that it manifests this time around is you have this like actual self-identified socialist on the left and this kind of European-style authoritarian populist on the right. And those are very different like philosophical groundings, and we've really seen have any influence in American politics in quite some time. One more thing about Bernie, though. So a lot has been made of the actual Bernie bro label as a way of like mocking or marginalizing Bernie supporters. It does seem to have some truth to it, where like especially if you go on Reddit or whatever, there are so many just like completely asinine, obnoxious Bernie people who will just hear no criticism whatsoever and who are just like going to town for their candidate in a way that they wouldn't for almost anybody else. At the same time, it feels like a kind of cheap way of dismissing a campaign which posed a greater challenge to Hillary than I think anyone, including Hillary and Sanders, would have expected at the time. So what do you make of the way that the two campaigns have kind of been treating each other and have now had to like reconcile behind a common cause?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's I may not have stated it super plainly yet, but I'm scared. The reason that I feel like Bernie would be doing everyone a huge favor is because I'm genuinely worried that now that after these conventions, it looks like Trump really has gained on Hillary, is closed the gap. Actually, I was looking on 538 earlier today, and they now have Trump at 50.1%. So very, very narrow favorite to become the next president. I'm nervous. I feel like because of, as you're saying, like I think you're right that calling them Bernie bros was like intentionally demeaning and like meant almost to not outcast them or make them feel like unwanted from the Democratic Party, but to certainly make them feel like they're doing the wrong thing, almost like they're hung up on Bernie for some illogical reason that if they were willing to set things aside and be reasonable about this, they would obviously be going for Hillary, but because they're Bernie bros, they just can't see that. I do feel bad for them and how it did really seem like the Bernie campaign, as I said earlier, was like really fighting an uphill battle, not just because of being behind on name recognition and money and donations and endorsements and everything, but because of having the actual entire party seemingly wanting Hillary involved there. At the same time, I think now they're handling it really, really poorly. And I understand that there's going to be a lot of frustration given the way things went down. But I would feel like when Bernie is at the convention, essentially pleading with them to vote Hillary and saying, this is what we've got to do, I would really hope that more of them are starting to come around. I still don't know. I still see, and maybe it's just because I am a late 20s guy in Maine, I still see a lot of people on my Facebook timeline posting about Bernie and how they're not going to vote for Hillary. And that terrifies me.
Yeah, I don't think it's surprising that Hillary, who has been at the center of the Democratic establishment for the past 25 years, will get the support of that establishment over someone who isn't actually a Democrat and who only joined the race as a Democrat in order to run against Hillary. So I don't think that's surprising. But yeah, I think in terms of the Bernie bro label, there is something to be said that like that kind of messianic fervor, like that kind of hero worship that gets brought to Sanders and to Trump on the other side, and also you think back to Obama in 2008, I think back to Tony Blair in my own country, I think of Justin Trudeau at the moment, that only ever seems to be applied to men. Even the diehard Hillary supporters, the tone of their support seems to be a lot different to me. And I'm not saying that the Bernie fans wouldn't have enthusiastically supported like Elizabeth Warren, let's say, if she had run, but there is a case to be made that like it's a lot easier to run as this like all things to all people, I'm the savior of the world figure, as a guy who's mainly appealing to guys.
Right. No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that Bernie, there was definitely an air of this guy's the chosen one. He's sent here to lead our people to righteousness and prosperity. Whereas with Hillary, even from her most ardent supporters, it doesn't seem to be she's the chosen one. It seems to be it's time. We're ready now for Hillary.
Yeah. And I think also this does tap into this growing divide, certainly within the Democrats, but you see this in other parties of the left elsewhere in the world as well, of like making the material and economic arguments versus making like the identity and culture arguments. So for Bernie, who's like this old white guy who's endlessly going on about campaign finance and taking down the banks and, you know, fundamentally overhauling the economy. And then on the other side, you have Hillary Clinton, who, as the first realistic woman who could win the presidency, that is of massive symbolic importance to not just Hillary supporters, but to, I think, the country as a whole. And coming off the heels of Barack Obama, who had the same kind of importance, and who also, but who is making the argument that, well, fundamentally the system is okay, but we need to like tweak it around the edges to make sure that it does better things for more people. And so you have this like complete chasm between the two sides, almost, where if you're a Bernie supporter driven to him for those reasons, versus if you're a Hillary fan drawn to her for those reasons, you're going to be fundamentally at odds because you're looking for two different things from what effectively are two different parties within the same label.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're definitely right. I think there is something of a divide within the left right now, and I think probably the Hillary versus Bernie thing had a lot to do with that. And I do want to be clear, like, I'm sure I've come across multiple times as essentially saying, hey, idiot, sore loser, Bernie bros, get your head out of your ass and vote for Hillary because it's the right thing to do. And I don't necessarily mean to be like that blunt or that bold about it, but I do think at larger point here, as the Democrats are faced with this situation where maybe they are divided, they should at least be focusing on the common goal of defeating Donald Trump. I feel like that has to take priority. The same way we were talking a little earlier about, sure, maybe there are considerations for voting third party because I want my voice to be heard 20 years from now. I want to be around 20 years from now. I want the economy to not be in the toilet in 2018.
Right, but I think this is like what we said earlier about if Donald Trump loses, then the issues that have been dredged up by this election will still be there and still be relevant in 4, 8, 12 years. And I think this contest between Bernie and Hillary, even if, like, let's say most of the Bernie supporters end up voting for Hillary, which I think they will, and she ends up beating Trump, that doesn't mean that in 4, 8, 12 years, we're not going to have the same kind of divide within the party that's now growing ever and ever wider. Because this seems to me the first time in a long time that, like, the actual left of the Democratic Party has had mainstream representation in the form of Bernie Sanders, and they've actually come somewhat close to winning a nomination.
I mean, Hillary's pretty far left. Hillary is, well, she's not Bernie Sanders socialist, but she's, as far as a lot of her major policies that differ from the GOP go, she's pretty left-leaning.
If you ask the GOP, sure, but I think for a lot of people within the Democratic Party, she would not be considered a left-wing figure.
No, I mean, I think she plays it too safe to be a super left-wing figure.
And also, I think there's this wider sense of distrust where, like, in the event that Hillary does support a traditional left-wing policy, it's because she's trying to appeal to some constituency and not because she actually believes that. Like we saw this with the debates over social issues where, like, Hillary was a very late convert to the cause of gay marriage, from what it seemed. And there were people saying, well, does she, like, has her mind actually changed about that, or is she doing it now because it's politically expedient to support it?
Yeah, I was not familiar with that, and that does surprise me. But at least, well, certainly, hey, by the way, gun people, get ready to go to bat for your, by which I mean, get ready to go to bats because you are no longer going to have your guns anymore once Hillary gets her way, gets in there.
The bats versus knives debate that dominated 2+2 for some time might actually become relevant again.
That's right. Yeah, let's quickly talk about her vice presidential selection here, Tim Kaine. We talked about this briefly when we were talking about Pence, which is, I really feel like the vice presidential selections seem to just, at least primarily and almost exclusively, take into consideration how is this person going to help us win this exact election, and who really cares what they do when they're vice president, unless it's, like, there are certainly situations like Dick Cheney or whatever, where he's essentially going to become the president.
Yeah, and Tim Kaine, I think, is the quintessential Clinton pick, where if she is seen as like a successful but maybe slightly untrustworthy figure, then Tim Kaine is like a safe pair of hands that everyone, even if you don't agree with him on everything, he seems like a nice enough guy. He's like this dad figure that everyone's kind of making fun of, but he's not threatening in the way that a lot of people view Hillary Clinton as, and you can debate like the gender coding of that or whatever, but Tim Kaine is just a nice, he's like a glass of warm milk. He's just kind of, you know, he's very agreeable, and that's what people want here. And I think it fits with Clinton's natural tendencies as well to just want to pick someone like that, especially in an election where you have the least safe pair of hands that you can possibly imagine running against you on the other side. I think having someone who is boring in a good way is an act of virtue in this cycle.
He speaks Spanish. I don't know if you noticed that when he was working in 40% of his speeches in Spanish.
It reminds me of the story that Mitt Romney apparently speaks French, but he had to hide that fact because the Republican base just hates French so much.
That's so funny. That's like minus points if he speaks French.
Which, yeah, given that half of England hates the French too, I can sympathize with that. It's fine.
That's a stare. I've never heard that about Romney. That's so funny. I'm just fascinated by both Pence and Kaine. The decisions, as far as I can tell, and not, I'm sure there's plenty more to these guys, but as far as the kind of position that they'll serve as vice presidential running mate, it seems to me like Pence was blatantly an appeal for the far right, probably like almost Tea Party votes, super conservative. And Kaine really stands out as just the most milquetoast person I've ever seen, just the most inoffensive, kind of like don't rock the boat at all. He's reliable. He's fine. Don't sweat it. It's Tim Kaine. You don't have to worry about it.
And that is exactly what they were going for, I think. And if that's your criterion, then Tim Kaine is a slam dunk.
Well, I mean, he was someone, at least a month before she actually made it official, he was the person that I had been heard rumored to be high up on the list for her, which just actually, you know, just actually having seen him now sort of surprises me. But I guess they certainly know what they're doing. It just really stood out to me that, like, who's eager to vote for Tim Kaine? I didn't see him pulling in more votes.
Well, as I recall, he was in the mix in 2008 as well as a possible VP pick. But I think the logic is the same as Obama picking Joe Biden, where there are lots of people who, for whatever reason, they don't know if they can fully commit to the top of the ticket. And so having someone in that second role who just is as predictable, as expectable as you can get is exactly what you're going for.
Well, at least Biden was a experienced guy from the Northeast to complement Obama, who was relatively inexperienced from the Midwest, whereas Hillary's got all the experience she could ever ask for a presidential candidate. And it really doesn't seem like Tim Kaine being, like, spoiler alert, Hillary's not going to do well in the Midwest, I would imagine. A lot of Central America. Or not Central America, you know what I'm saying? North America.
Yeah, but Virginia was a swing state, right? And having the governor of Virginia right there is a good way to shore that up.
That's true. Is it one of
the governor of New Jersey, as some have misattributed to him. But I think you're right that with Biden, there was a question over Obama's lack of experience. And so having someone who was clearly experienced helped to shore that up. I think with Kaine, it's the same thing, but in a different way, where the deficiency that Hillary has is, like, for a lot of swing voters, they're like, okay, well, she's been around the block, she knows her stuff, but there's kind of like this nagging, this like lingering doubt that I have over whether I can fully trust her and commit to her. And Tim Kaine is the kind of guy where it's like, you don't really have any questions about him. You would give the keys to your car or your house to Tim Kaine. Like, he is just a straightforward, trustworthy guy, and that's what they want. Maybe emphasis on the guy part there as well.
Yeah. That was actually something that we should talk about. Is the prospect of her picking Elizabeth Warren. Did you have any ideas about that, of having a woman ticket?
Yeah, so it feels a lot more radical and interesting than Hillary would want to go for in a campaign like this. Like, if she starts with an advantage over Trump, which I hope and believe she does, then one way to jeopardize that would be if you pick Elizabeth Warren and that turns off too many people for whatever reason.
I agree. I think that's exactly right. I think she's at least should be playing this election to not lose and not make critical errors that could cost her a ton of votes. Because I think if she just plays this straightforward, she'll be probably fine.
And also, you hear a lot of people saying about Trump that, oh, he's just appealing to, like, angry white men, which is true. But I think even those people don't fully appreciate how, like, uniquely masculine, if you like, Trump's campaign is trying to be. And so, like it is very much about this kind of strong man image, right, where you have this blustery, boisterous leader who's just gonna impose his will on things with an iron fist. And so if, as Hillary Clinton, you have an all-female ticket, that plays right into Trump's hands when he's going for, like, generic, like, late 30s white male small business owner in Midwestern swing state, right?
Yeah. To quickly go back to Tim Kaine as the actual vice president, what you were talking about of like, oh, he's Tim Kaine, you don't have anything to worry about. Honestly, and I tweeted this out, and it's going to sound like it's a joke, and it kind of is, but it's kind of not. This guy reminded me so much just vocally of Mike Scoopin. And like, to me, seeing Mike Scoopin just behave that way and come across as like a, hey, happy-go-lucky kind of guy, and knowing the kind of duplicitous shit that Mike Scoopin is capable of, I at least have a couple concerns about Tim Kaine potentially not being all that he's cracked up to be. But I think way more likely than not, he is the Kyle MacLachlan mayor in Portlandia, where he really is just the happy-go-lucky politician.
Well, tune in next week for the phrenology of Tim Kaine, where Tim Kaine and Mike Scoopin have the same skull size, so therefore, there's no substance behind that, I don't think.
I think there is. I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on that. I'm pretty sure they're the same person.
Sure. What did you make of the Obamas in their role at the convention? Because for Obama as the outgoing president, a two-term president who has pretty high approval ratings, who is a very popular figure within his own party, but who is now handing over the torch to someone who ran a very heated campaign against him in 2008. And it's easy to forget, now that they've been working together for so long, just how nasty that became at times. Like, you know, what is his position here, and what did you make of the way that he and Michelle went about making the case for Hillary?
Sure. Well, first of all, I would think that once Obama beat Hillary in 2008, at least for him, the nastiness ended. He no longer cared any hard feelings. I would imagine once he got it, he would stop caring. And certainly by now, he would stop caring.
Most of the nastiness was not from him, to be fair, but.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Any nastiness towards him, I think he would stop caring as soon as things went his way. He's now been president for 8 years. It's water under the bridge, whatever. It's time. We certainly can't let Trump get in over her. I thought Obama totally, during his entire speech, had the essentially like senioritis, like last term of senior year of high school where like you've already been accepted to a college and all you need to do is like not get arrested and you'll be fine and you've already graduated essentially. I felt like he definitely had that kind of vibe going on. I'm really interested to see what Obama ends up doing after this. I think a couple of things are definitely in play. They're certainly, I'm sure it's going to be compelling to just play a lot of golf and basketball, give a few speeches a year and for like $100,000 a pop and call it a life. I don't think any of the rest of his family has any political aspirations or anything, at least not yet.
So if Michelle Obama did and she wanted to take the Hillary Clinton route, I think a lot of people would be receptive for that, especially after the just absolute sensation of a speech that she gave at the DNC this year.
That's what I was going to get onto. I thought Michelle, who I believe led off night one, this is what led me to start thinking along these lines about his family potentially being interested in politics. I know his daughters are quite young for that still at this point. But I was thinking like, man, if this does end up going Hillary for 8 years, I could potentially see it being Michelle Obama if she gets some cabinet position handed to her early on, then gets 8 years inside like the West Wing. I could see Michelle Obama certainly up there acting pretty presidential.
It was interesting too because I think a Barack Obama speech was perceived not as a flop necessarily, but it didn't really get the people going in a way that you would expect someone who is an historically amazing orator to really accomplish there. Whereas Michelle just blew the roof off, and she was the one who really came out of that convention looking like the new big thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was, while I was watching it, it was pretty incredible and amazing to think back to the convention in 2004 when I was a junior in high school. And I was a big-time Howard Dean fan, and Howard Dean was going to talk on, like, Wednesday night after he didn't get the nomination, and the person who introduced him was Barack Obama, and that was when he first came on to, like, the national spotlight, and I remember just watching this random guy from Illinois bring in Howard Dean, and I was like, wow, that guy was amazing, and the next morning, all anyone was talking about was this guy, Barack Obama, and then in 2008, he was back there, and now he's about to be done in 2016 with 8 years as president. It was pretty amazing, and actually, seeing clips of him from back in 2004, he looks 30 years younger.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what the presidency does to people. Like, you can see the gray hairs really starting to take control now.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think it's going to be really interesting. I was actually talking a little bit with a good friend of the podcast, Antonio Mazzaro, the other day, and he thought about possibly Supreme Court for Barack Obama. I think that's he's certainly young enough. It's definitely in play. Hillary would happily appoint him, I'm sure.
I've heard that photo too. If you want to rustle the jimmies of congressional Republicans, that would be the absolute perfect way to do it. I'm pretty sure. Like they spent so long making and losing the argument against Obama, just it like electorally as well as politically. And now, if he is going to be installed in a, I guess in theory it's non-political, but in practice it's highly political. If you install him in that position for life, then that is a like a permanent middle finger to everyone on that side. So
yeah.
I could see her and him both being willing to go for that.
I'm wondering, because his daughters are, I think they're still in high school or about to start college by now, but they're still young. I'm guessing Obama is certainly not going to want to jump on the Supreme Court the next time there's a vacancy or anything. I could definitely see him kind of just taking it easy. I'm sure he's going to be completely, you know, every minute of every day of the rest of his life is going to be spoken for with like speaking engagements or whatever, or Secret Service details or what have you. But I could see him relatively speaking, kind of taking it easy, almost like Jimmy Carter style, like finding some passion project and pursuing that, the same way that Jimmy Carter builds houses for Habitat for Humanity.
Well, he's only, what, is it 52 at the moment, something like that? So, yeah, I mean, he still has a good 20, 30 years of public life left in front of him if he wants it. So
I think he's older, a little older than that, but whatever.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's remarkably young for someone who's done being president. I mean, he really is faced with the Jed Bartlett what's next, right?
Yeah, I guess. And I guess that kind of ended on a cliffhanger. And again, for Obama, like he really gets to determine his own future now in a way that I think a lot of presidents, like, okay, George Bush is going back to his ranch or whatever and just spends his days painting, apparently. I think Barack Obama will be more involved in the public eye than that, but it remains to be seen how.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure he's going to, for as long as he's around, be one of the most popular people for former presidents, certainly among Democrats, but I'm guessing just universally, from what it sounds like, based on how you said Europe seems to just fawn over him.
Right. It's weird with Bill, given the whole Hillary connection, but if Hillary hadn't run, or at least in like the 08 to like 2014 period, Bill was like this elder statesman figure, right, where it's like, he was one of the go-to people if you wanted a high-ranking Democrat. And Obama might be the same way, where if there's some like diplomatic thing that it makes sense to not have the actual Secretary of State go for, then maybe President Clinton would like enlist Obama to go and make the case or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I always thought that Obama might try to get Bill involved in either like Israel-Palestine or in Ireland or whatever, like some kind of like international diplomacy.
There was that mission to North Korea, right, where like Bill Clinton goes and rescues the, which was just absolutely surreal when I heard about that. I was like, oh, how does this even make any sense? But he apparently did it, so credit to him, I suppose.
He went and played basketball with Dennis Rodman and Uncle Cliffy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great, like, watching the celebrity mole and thinking, not only does this guy actually win a season of a game which is, in theory, you know, social and strategic and so on, but he just goes off to North Korea on a whim to play basketball with dictators. It's like, well, how is this a real human being?
Well, I believe it's the case, and I don't think I've heard of this about virtually anyone else. This is much more common in football, where, like, in football, they'd never played a down of football until they got to college, but they were just, like, physically gifted or whatever. I'm pretty sure Dennis Rodman, never played basketball even in high school, which is, it's impossible to make a college team never having played before. And he started playing basketball when he was like 17 or 18 and ended up being one of the best defensive NBA players of all time. Like, Dennis Rodman is known for his hair and his crazy antics or whatever. He's a crazy, crazy good basketball player.
I can believe that for sure.
Yeah. All right. So I guess I'm curious, let's dive into Hillary a little bit more than we have. What does England and Europe in general think about Hillary, and how has that evolved since she's become, you know, gone from first lady? I guess you were very young when that was the case, but were you even born when she was first lady to now being like the major candidate?
What do you mean, was I even born when she was first lady?
You were born under her being first lady. She was first lady when you were born.
Bill had been elected, but she hadn't been inaugurated yet. So I was kind of in the gap in the middle there.
Weren't you? You're December. Oh, yeah. Okay. He had been elected. He got sworn in 93.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. What do they think of Hillary, though? Sorry.
It's hard to tell. As I said, so much of the column inches that get devoted to this are given over to Donald Trump by his own design. Hillary, I think, there is a sense that like she is the smart choice, and you know, people obviously would vote for her. And there's like this poll of different countries around the world what the margin of Hillary's victory would be over Trump in those countries. And like Mexico is 54% or something, obviously. And then like even in the UK, it's 40 something, I believe. So there is a sense that like she should be the next president, but I don't think there's any great excitement over it. And especially the symbolic nature of her victory in a country where like we have a female prime minister and had one who was famously controversial back in the day, like that doesn't really, that's not really an issue for us in the same way at the moment.
So not nearly the same effect as Obama had on you guys in 08 or 12.
Oh, not nearly. Like Obama was, I won't say unprecedented, because it's like Tony Blair meets Princess Diana almost.
Unprecedented?
But Hillary, it's like, yeah, she's, yeah, like it's tough for me to talk about it because that just is the opinion. It's like, yeah, she's there and she's going to win, and that's okay, that's good. At least it isn't Trump, is in my view.
How did you think, what were you expecting, I guess, from Hillary? Did you watch her speech at the DNC?
I watched parts of it. I didn't catch a start, but I saw like the highlights and then went back and watched towards the end.
Because I really, really wasn't sure what I was expecting her to even be focusing on, but I thought it was just an interesting situation to be in where on the heels of Trump going 75 minutes at 800 decibels, how do you respond to that when you're the other candidate? And of course, Trump, the day after Hillary's speech, tweets out the following morning, oh, Thursday numbers are in, my speech on Thursday killed her speech on Thursday.
Of course. So it's tough for her because she's meant to unify the party and present a coherent case against Donald Trump, which by itself is very difficult to do because you can't coherently attack something that just isn't coherent by itself.
Did you see, by the way, we skipped over, Tim Kaine like did 20 minutes like roasting Donald Trump, like doing impressions and stuff. Did you see that?
I think in a bid to make himself interesting, which kind of like worked, but for the wrong reasons almost. But yeah, Hillary, I think she had this tough needle to thread where you have these Bernie Sanders supporters heckling her from the floor, and she needs to bring all of those people in the Sanders camp back into her camp. And so you see her like making these very obvious overtures like, oh, we're gonna stand up to Wall Street and so on, which given the whole Goldman Sachs speech thing, and then like when she said that, the network that I was watching on cut to Chelsea Clinton and her husband, who like worked for Goldman Sachs for 8 years or something, just like clapping from the audience kind of awkwardly. Like she has to make these feints and moves that she's not, that aren't natural for her to make, but which I think she understands she has to. And I think she did those pretty well. Like, as far as I could tell, the speech was well received. And obviously the diehard Sanders camp was always going to be against it no matter what. But I think a lot of them are seeing the case that you made, which is like, okay, yeah, we actually do need to just put this aside for now and get behind her. And so to that extent, I think it was a success.
Yeah, I think Hillary's in a really, really tough spot where I think she would probably love to be able to come out and say, what the fuck is wrong with you people? How is this even a decision? Policy is all that I've thought about for the last 30 years. This guy's a complete crackhead. But what she's forced to do is like take small edges where she can get them and just not mess up. And essentially, kind of like that Macarena video that we talked about, she often finds herself clapping along to the Macarena and looking inauthentic or whatever, just purely in an effort not to mess things up.
Yeah, my favorite brand of Twitter commentary nowadays is like juxtaposing made-up quotes from Clinton and Trump, where it's like Hillary saying, you need to Pokemon go to the polls in November, and then it's Trump saying, I want to reinstitute slavery, or something like that. Like,
yeah.
They never fail to make me laugh, because there is an element of truth to it. Like Hillary feels the need to pander in order to widen her base, which is understandable. And then Trump, it's almost like he is he's pandering more than anyone ever has, and then also not pandering at the same time, right? Where it's like, he just says whatever's on his mind, and because it always contradicts whatever he said 4 weeks ago, by definition, he's appealing to everyone in some way, but then also not appealing to, it's strange. It's so hard to intelligently describe the Trump phenomenon, because it really is that. It's a phenomenon of the likes of which we just haven't seen before.
Well, I think what it is, it's people, they're okay with him contradicting himself, you know, when he's asked the same question twice, 3 weeks apart, because they like about Trump oh, that guy just speaks what's on his mind. He tells it like it is. I can trust what he's saying because he's clearly not putting it through any bullshit filters. He's just letting it go out. And that's how I know that he's being honest with me. And my question, like, the concern, I think the disconnect for me there is that seems to suggest that him being honest about what his, you know, just his first impulsive reaction to everything is going to lead to profit if we just go with that every time. Like, that's, oh, that's, of course, that's going to work out.
Well, it's also like a self-defeating argument because if you're saying you can tell what Trump thinks about things, then great. That's more than you can do for most politicians. But we've seen what he thinks, and what he thinks is completely terrifying. So they're just like you have no excuse for even like tricking yourself into thinking he might be okay because he's told you up front that he won't be. So
well, that's what I mean. That's what I'm getting at is I think America is at such a point now where so many people are fed up with the relentless insistence that everything be politically correct down to the letter. And it's been at least a solid decade and a half of that kind of like overall, just kind of overarching environment here, this kind of like cloud looming over America of got to be politically correct about this, can't say that, can't do this. And I think, like I referenced earlier, Trump getting that huge applause break when he said, I'm the candidate to vote for if you don't want to be politically correct. I think that's what it comes down to for them. I don't think they're worried about his ideas being good. What they're interested in when it comes to Donald Trump is merely the fact that he's willing to speak his mind and not be politically correct. I think that's exactly what, him being politically incorrect is exactly what's getting him this far.
So let's get into how we think this might actually play out then. So you referenced the 538 figure earlier that Trump has just pushed over the 50% mark. When I checked that out on the site, I believe that was only taking one like set of things into account. It wasn't accounting for polls and other things, which had Hillary solidly ahead in like the 65% range, I think. But even that is a lot closer than most people would have anticipated. And also, if you said, like 8 months ago, Hillary's going to be going up against Trump in the general election, they wouldn't have believed that either. So there is like this prevailing sense of nothing we thought we knew can be trusted anymore. But equally, there are like these underlying just hard facts about the electoral math that even Trump, for all of his bombast, can't really escape. So what's your early read on this?
Well, I mean, the first time that we talked about this a little over a month ago during one of our Brexit podcasts, I said Trump had no chance. I thought my big forecast for this whole thing has come down to the debates. My thing is Trump is not going to be able to keep his shit together during those debates. He's going to lose his temper. He's going to scream at Hillary. He's going to say a ton of stuff that he's going to regret. And Hillary is not going to break. I think she's not going to bite, essentially. And I am really optimistic that certainly by the end of three couple hour long televised debates, people who were on the fence are probably going to be leaning more Hillary than Trump. I'm hoping that what you're saying is right and that 50.1% figure saying that Trump now had the edge on 538, that I was looking at the wrong one or whatever. But it looked, from what I've read, just following along their coverage, they had said throughout all of the conventions that Trump was gaining a lot on Hillary. For instance, I looked at their historical, what the percentages used to be. And the map that I was looking at, it went from Hillary at 74% on July 12th, right before the conventions, down to, as I said, down to now being a slight underdog to Trump after those conventions. So that's super terrifying to me.
Yeah, so looking over that projection that we were both talking about, one thing that stands out is there are some states which you would expect to be in one column or the other, which are either leaning or seem to be solidly in the other column already, and maybe that can change and they'll be up in play again. But you brought up the example of New Hampshire being in Trump's camp, which you found very surprising.
Yeah, I did. I mean, New England almost traditionally goes entirely across the board Democrat, and it was up until very recently being called for Hillary. I would be honestly quite surprised if that didn't end up swinging back to Hillary. But as of right now, 538 is projecting a slight Trump win in New Hampshire, as things stand right now. I also thought the other ones just – the states that I just cross-referenced, the states that Obama won in 2012 against Mittens, that they're calling for Trump right now. New Hampshire, the one that stood out big time for me. Ohio, they're calling for Trump. Nevada, they're calling for Trump. And Florida, they're calling for Trump right now. Obviously, a huge, huge electoral college swing with all of the, I think it's 25 electoral college votes in Florida. So that's probably the real difference maker out of all of those. But the fact that he is, at least as things stand right now, pulling those four states, all of which to a certain extent surprised me, is at least beating Hillary as things stand now in those states, really leaves me nervous.
Yeah, this might be a good time to transition into a listener question that we had. So Toby, who manages like an odds-checking website, wrote in to say, putting aside the campaign rhetoric, what hugely significant practical changes will be happening in the U.S. or the world a year or more after Trump becomes president, if he does? And so I guess this ties into something else I wanted to ask, which is, what's the best-case scenario if Trump gets elected? Like, what are we meant to hope for? And I think the idea is, all of those checks and balances that the framers so wisely put in place, you know, however long ago, that those are going to come to bear and really be stretched to their limits here, but hopefully can contain the full extent of Trump's madness, and that he's essentially going to be like the figurehead who is making an embarrassment of himself and the country, but that the actual decisions behind the scenes are going to be taken by people who are within the boundaries of normal political life, even if those are like establishment Republicans who in any other context we might find terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, he's talking about, oh, I'm going to have the best negotiators, I'm going to have the best advisors, you've never heard of them, don't worry about it, that he's going to have advising him for when he's president. My big concern as far as like what's demonstrably going to be changing once we get a little ways into a Trump presidency is, for me, if he really is the face of the country and he is the one, as I'm sure he's going to want to be, making the negotiations himself and like and bartering with other countries or whatever, I do not see it being the case that he can go a calendar year without making some very powerful enemies, just saying the wrong things to the wrong people. Like that is it. That is my biggest concern.
Yeah, I don't know enough about how the House and Senate races look to talk about that, but you could conceivably have a situation where you have a Republican House or Senate being almost as obstructionist towards Trump as they have been towards Obama, just in terms of like not being willing or able to work with someone, which for a president of their own party would be pretty startling.
I mean, I mentioned Maine having the worst governor in the country by a mile, and that's Paul LePage, and that's exactly what he does. He openly antagonizes like our state Senate and things like House of Representatives, things like those lines, things along those lines, where he will, and certainly, particularly with Democrats, he leads the entire country like all time in vetoes or whatever. And actually, hysterically, one time he was trying to slow roll a bunch of vetoes, like 100 vetoes. He was trying to wait till the last second and then let the time expire, and they all became laws. It was amazing. Like, that's just the level of stupidity. And it's exactly the same situation. Like, he is the Trump figure of Maine. He was not a politician. He was a business guy who openly hates the government that he works for. He's been a complete disaster from start to finish, refuses to work with the people who it is key for him to be working with for, like, the benefit of this state. I see exactly the same thing happening with Donald Trump on a national scale. Learn from the state of Maine. Don't split your fucking votes. Don't put the guy in office.
What do you think we can learn about political messaging and advertising, I guess, from the way that Trump seems to have single-handedly, without really devoting too much time or money to it, just captured an entire party by himself without any institutional support and really connected with people in a way that no one, including himself, I think, really anticipated from the outset? Like, he's tapped into something, and the question is, how has he done that, and how can we defeat it to make sure that someone like Trump or Trump himself won't be able to succeed on that basis?
My question would be if it is the kind of the messaging that he's doing or the branding, or if it's the people that are just inherently receptive and just kind of want that Trump persona, even if it makes absolutely no fucking sense. They need that guy. Kind of, I don't think it makes them feel safe or whatever. It just makes them feel like they're not totally disenfranchised. Like someone with any kind of power is at least in there working almost against the government. Like, I think they like that he's kind of antagonizing all of the people that he's potentially supposed to be working with. I think they want him in there breaking things up. And I don't know if the brand, like, again, I don't know if it goes back to him being a master with the media and working all the angles to get all this free airtime or whatever. I think he's just hitting a nerve for a lot of people that in, you know, just over the course of the last 15, 20 years has been building up.
Yeah, there's a lot of noise that gets made about how hard it is to kind of empathize in a fundamental way with people who don't share your values, don't share your politics. And a lot of the time, I think if you make a genuine effort, you can overcome that. I think with Trump, though, it's maybe more difficult than it's ever been, where, like, you see all of these people who in person, like, very polite and civil and seemed pretty just reasonable about things and not prone to, like, these massive outbursts or just blowing up on people, and who they seem to be just, like, pretty normal, good people, but who also just, like, look at what Trump's offering and think, yeah, I want some of that. And it seems so, like, incongruent with just the way that they themselves handle life.
It's really, I really wonder what kind of conditions there have to be for someone like Trump to rise to prominence. And I think it's interesting just because we'll talk about Brexit soon, but we have Boris Johnson over in England, who is kind of like the Trump figure over there. And then as your boy John Oliver highlighted a few weeks ago, there's that guy in the Philippines now who's like the Trump figure over there. It really does seem like, for whatever reason, it is a message that's resonating with people all over the world right now.
Yeah, and in terms of the actual messaging, like the language of it, the way that Trump speaks, I think, is very unique, very distinctive, and all of the best orators have their own personal style and everything. But, like, if I showed you a Hillary speech, you might be able to guess from the context that it was a Hillary speech, or from the level of detail or whatever. But it wouldn't be that far removed from any other politician's speech, right? Like it's not quintessential Hillary Clinton boilerplate. Whereas with Trump, you can read what he says, you can listen to what he says, you can tell that it's him. It is identifiably Trump. And just like the way that he sets that up, I don't even know if it's a conscious thing or just the way that his mind operates, but like the way that he frames things in like very short, like staccato, simple terms and keeps repeating those over and over again until they gain traction. Like some of it, I'm sure, is intentional. Like the crooked Hillary thing, I know there's a temptation to like compare everything to like Veep or Game of Thrones, The House of Cards. The actual comparison that you want is ancient Greek epic poetry, because in the Iliad, okay, you have Homer constantly using like these epithets where you have whenever Achilles appears on the story, it's always swift-footed Achilles. So like he keeps repeating this even in circumstances where it is not pertinent to the story and where it doesn't actually make any sense, where like the actual point of what's coming up is Achilles is not being fast whatsoever. But because he just repeats this over and over again, you can't think of Achilles without thinking of swift-footed. You can't think of swift-footed without thinking of Achilles. And I feel like he's trying to do the same thing with Hillary. Like, Hillary is crooked Hillary, right? And you had Lying Ted and Little Marco, which I think was the best one. It's a very almost ingenious form of messaging where it's like, he's saying, don't think of an elephant, where you're going to think of the elephant no matter what he says now. And so even if you completely disagree with Trump, even if you find everything he says repulsive, it's hard to think of Hillary without thinking, yeah, crooked Hillary. And you have to like check yourself to get out of that mindset now.
At least, I mean, I feel like at least for me, I don't do the crooked Hillary math. And even if I did, I would say, oh, well, I'm only doing that because I see that Donald Trump tweets. And I do follow Trump and Hillary on Twitter, by the way. They are both very entertaining follows. I would highly recommend following both of them. I would say it's to stay informed, but really it's to laugh a lot. Particularly at Trump. No, I think you're totally right. I think, like, it is, while I am someone, I hope, who is able to see through that kind of, like, subliminal, not even subliminal, like, blatant advertising and kind of message reinforcement, calling her crooked Hillary every time, I think it is, he does it because it works. I think you're exactly right that there are plenty of people who do when they follow Trump on Twitter all day and they're waiting to watch the GOP debate that night, they're going to watch Trump go and they've heard all day is how he's going to go and argue with lightweight Rubio.
Right. And I think the best one maybe subtly was low energy Jeb Bush, where it's like it tapped into what everyone was already thinking about Jeb but didn't really know how to express or articulate, or maybe they were too polite to say it themselves. Where it's like, yeah, he is low energy and he is a kind of fairly laid back, reserved person, because and that's a good thing in many contexts, but he was able to take that and turn it into something that was undoubtedly negative. And there was nothing that Jeb could possibly do to shake that label, because if he tried to inject more energy, if he tried to like act up and be this big character, it would seem so out of place and so inauthentic that it just would never possibly work. So Trump like managed to trap him between a rock and a hard place.
Right. I think Cochran's monologue about Julia Landauer being vanilla not being a fair term, because children clamor for a vanilla ice cream cone and no one is clamoring for Julia or Jeb. I think it's along similar lines with Trump, where maybe he's not even as good of an ice cream flavor for the country, but at least he's got more flavor to him. Like maybe it's flavor that's going to give us cancer in 2 weeks, but that's still something.
So with that, and that's by no means exhaustive. There's still so much more to get to, and I'm sure we'll do another part as we get closer to Election Day and maybe after that too. Let's talk about the situation over here, because there were some people asking for a part three for the Brexit cast that we did, and a lot more has happened since the second one, and I'm sure a lot more will continue to happen, even though things are in a more regular rhythm for now. So when we left off, I believe we knew that David Cameron was going to resign. We knew that Jeremy Corbyn was in the midst of being toppled or supposedly toppled by his own party. And the question was, how is all of this going to shake out? So the expectation at the time was Boris Johnson teaming up with Michael Gove would be the big ticket in the leadership race. And all of that kind of fell apart very quickly because Michael Gove pulled like a move out of Shakespeare and stabbed Boris in the back. Basically saying, I don't think Boris is the right man for the moment. I don't think he's fit for the role. And I'm going to run myself as the representative from our side, which basically caused this defection away from Boris. And so Boris turns up to his own campaign launch where everyone was expecting him to kick things off, having only been informed like less than 5 minutes previously that his best friend and running mate in the process was about to stab him in the back and go against him. And shocks everyone who was there by announcing that he was going to stand down. So Boris, who everyone thought basically won the election by himself in order to run for leadership and become prime minister, was now out of the way. And so there was this big, there's like this open question now about what was going to happen. So a few people stepped into the breach. So you had from the Remain side, their chosen one was Theresa May, who had been spoken about as a possible future leader for some time, and there was an expectation that she was going to run, and spoiler alert, she does end up winning in the end. But the way that we get there is quite interesting. The next person to jump into the ring, now that Boris, who's like the major heavyweight, is gone, is an unknown figure, relatively, called Andrea Leadsom, who, it was generally agreed, had a pretty good Brexit campaign. So she had been on a lot of the talk shows and panel shows and things, making the case for the Leave side. And there weren't that many respected figures on the Leave side, as we covered. And so someone who came across as fairly composed and articulate like she did would automatically shoot up the power rankings in terms of who would be the most high-profile Leavers. And so she really took advantage of that. And so she put herself into the race, and a lot of the former Boris support now, well, Boris himself, it clearly is not going to support Michael Gove, and if he now supports someone who was on the Remain side in Theresa May, who he had had some arguments with, then that would seem out of place too. So now he throws his support behind the only real figure left in the race by process of elimination, which is this Andrea Leadsom, who is just arriving on the scene. But it turns out that, just as we saw with Sarah Palin, when you have someone who was hitherto unknown and who is suddenly thrust onto the national stage, firstly, they don't often respond to the pressure that well. And also, there are lots of these skeletons in their closet that get unearthed, which just had no reason to be examined in the past. And so,
teenage daughter preaching anti...
Sorry about that. Yeah. Although, but much less than that in Andrea Leadsom's case. So it turned out that she had fabricated parts of her CV when she was applying for these important jobs. And so Twitter really took that and ran with it. And so there were lots of jokes out there about, you know, Andrea Leadsom like applying for the post of England manager, or, you know, she's qualified for the role because she like she beat the Normans in 1066 or whatever. Like there's lots of good content about it. She now is unaccustomed to this pressure, and she's facing a lot of it. And so in the first real like hardcore interview that she goes through, she pretty much cracks, and she ends up just babbling, essentially just spouting complete arrant nonsense that turns off a lot of the people who were there. It also turns out that her support for Brexit was itself a calculated political move, because a few years ago she had gone on record in the media saying, I think Brexit would be harmful, as someone who works in the city. And her position as someone who worked in the city, firstly, just the very fact of working in the city was not going to go down well in some quarters because of this antipathy towards the bankers and so on. But then also, she tried to exaggerate how important her role was in the city, saying that she was like a head of a major department for one of the largest banks, and lots of people who worked with her, worked alongside her, came out to say, no, you weren't. You basically had no real importance here. Like, okay, good for you. You had a decent job, but it's not nearly what you're making it out to be. And so her credibility basically was shot to pieces from the get-go. Meanwhile, as all of this is going on, Nigel Farage doesn't really know what to do with himself now, because his side has won, but it's very clear that he's not going to be involved in any official capacity with either the Brexit negotiations, which haven't started yet, and we don't know when they're going to start, and more on that in a second, but also he's not going to have any government position, and his own party still is in this fractured state after the infighting during the campaign. So he shocks a lot of people himself by coming out and saying, okay, I've done what I wanted to achieve. I've had enough. I'm going to step down and someone else can take over. So what you have now is Boris is gone and Nigel Farage is gone. And shortly afterwards, Gove loses round one of the leadership election and has to drop out himself. So now you have the three major architects of the Leave vote, none of whom are in their positions anymore. So there's really no voice articulating the Leave side other than this newcomer, Andrea Leadsom. And so in one of the more unusual twists, if you like, a lot of the former UKIP supporters now rally behind Andrea Leadsom, even though under normal circumstances, none of them would want to have anything to do with her, just because she is literally the only person left in there who's advocating their position. And so you see the phenomenon of like Trump supporters on Twitter, right, who just like attack people who disagree with them, who are engaging in all of these conspiracy theories and so on. You have that to a lesser degree with the UKIP supporters. You'd have all of these like cyber UKIPers leaping to the defense of someone who 2 weeks ago they'd never heard of and who they still don't have any real trust in or any real faith in, just because she happens to be the person who's representing them. And as like this kind of very posh middle-aged woman, she's very unlike the typical UKIP voter, to put it mildly. So you have this very weird scene of all of them just like this motley crew just lining up behind her. And then that dissipates pretty quickly too, when she basically decides, I can't hack it here. Theresa May is clearly going to win, and I'm only embarrassing myself and the party by staying in. So she drops out. So the situation which I flagged up about a month ago now when we did our last podcast about this, of this the next prime minister being decided by the Conservative Party members voting on this, that never even came to pass. Theresa May was just went through this coronation unopposed, essentially. And so no one got to decide who the new prime minister was going to be other than Conservative MPs, which was what they wanted all along. You end up with this just bizarre state of affairs where Brexit wins. As a result of that, the pro-Remain prime minister has to resign, and all of his team, all of this political structure that he built up collapses around him. And yet all of the main Leave figures are out of the picture too. And the new prime minister is a solid Remainer who is on that side and has been on that side for a long time, who now is having to handle this outcome, handle these negotiations, despite having very little support in Parliament and despite having no real support from the country either. So it's a very weird time to be in.
Sounds like you guys totally nailed it. It sounds like mission established, mission accomplished.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So David Cameron is out now. He's already gone?
He is gone. He's retired to go on Murdoch's yacht or do cocaine or whatever it is that they used to do. And George Osborne, who we didn't mention much, but he's like the kind of Svengali figure who, like, David Cameron was the acceptable face of the government, but George Osborne was like the big, he was his sidekick, he was the number two guy who was a chancellor, and he was like the big political schemer behind the scenes. He was basically fired in public by Theresa May in her first reshuffle, saying, we have no use for you anymore, and we're not going to have the usual convention of, oh, you can pretend to resign to save face. You have been sacked, and we're going to make it very clear to the press that you have been sacked. So as someone who essentially loathed Osborne, I loved seeing that. However, I don't know if it was that wise politically, given that George Osborne had this big base of support in the party, and the majority for the Conservatives in Parliament was only with like less than 20, and that's rapidly dwindling itself. So she really can't afford to be alienating like vast swathes of her own MPs, and yet that's what she basically set up by doing.
How secure is her position? Is she in there for a while for sure?
I have to think so. Like, you can imagine if the majority falls apart, and the very narrow majority, and they have to call a new election because they lose a vote of no confidence, then maybe she could be unturfed in that. But as we'll get onto in a second, the opposition really is in no state to oppose her at the moment. And after they've deposed one prime minister, they're going to be in no hurry to depose a second. So even if she gets off to a bad start, which it looks like she's found her footing for the moment, then it's very unlikely that there'll be any moves made against her, at least in the short term.
Is David Cameron considered like one of the worst prime ministers ever?
So it's been less than a month, and it's hard to say where his conclusive position will fall. But there is a sense of like, you had it all and you threw it away for no good reason. Like this all comes back to you. You can't blame anybody else. This is your fault. And it really depends on how Brexit itself ends up going, or if it even ends up happening. But I think he will. It's certainly the biggest unforced error that we've seen. And in terms of like going from hero to zero, where I think if he had continued on track, he would be seen as like a decent, like competent kind of second tier prime minister. And now he's certainly going to be languishing towards the bottom somewhere.
I remember watching like the season premiere or an early episode of some random season of, it may not have even been the Celebrity Apprentice. It may have been the original Apprentice or Civilian Apprentice, where one guy, like somehow he was like the project manager and like had immunity or something. And he gave up his immunity to like make a statement. And then Trump fired him immediately. He goes, don't give up your immunity. Like, don't, it sounds like David Cameron essentially had it made. He didn't need to force the issue. He forced the issue and it got turned around on him.
The notorious Bradford, I believe you're referring to.
Sure.
Which, by the way, at some point, I want to go back and watch those early seasons of The Apprentice again, just to see how differently perception is now that we have this entirely new picture of Donald Trump. Like
Mike Bloom just did. He watched all of The Apprentice seasons again. I don't know if he did all of them, or at least he did at least the Celebrity Apprentice ones.
Did he podcast about them yet?
I don't think so yet, but I'm sure he will at some point.
All right, so might earmark him for that if he hasn't done it already. But Cameron is kind of in disgrace, but like he still is like a multimillionaire. He's going to go back to a very comfy life with his family. So very hard to have any real sympathy for him.
What do we have to look forward to with Theresa May now that it's her time to shine?
Okay, so it turns out that the rumors of Boris's death were greatly exaggerated, because in her first major act as prime minister, she names Boris Johnson as the foreign secretary. So basically, the Secretary of State, which if you know anything about Boris and you know anything about that role, they don't seem like he really doesn't seem like a natural fit, to put it mildly.
Yeah. Well, that's going to be very, very exciting. Are you nervous about Boris being in that kind of position? Like the same way that I am certainly not alone in being nervous about the prospect of Trump potentially coming into power.
Well, you had like the French foreign secretary openly just flabbergasted at the fact that he would now have to work with Boris, and multiple other figures doing so as well. There is some hope that Boris will rise to that position. And like for as much as we want to compare Trump and Boris, like Trump is just an actual know-nothing, whereas Boris is a very well-educated guy and a very smart guy, but who hides it behind this like jester image, if you like. And so there is a hope that if he can just like knuckle down and get on with the job, then he could make something decent of it. Don't know how realistic that hope is, to be honest, but that's at least what we're hoping for. I think it's a very shrewd political move in a way, because not only did she do that, but two other people who are prominent Brexiteers, she named in the positions that have to deal with all of the thorny details regarding Brexit. So she's basically put the gauntlet down to them, saying, okay, you led the charge of this, you voted for it, now you're going to have to deal with it. And so if it blows up, it's going to blow up on them, and their credibility will be damaged. And also now, they can't be outside the tent pissing in and criticizing the way that it's being handled, because they are the ones handling it. So she's kind of moved in advance to negate one of the main sources of potential criticism. So you can see why she might want to make that move, and it's a smart move. But in terms of the actual conduct of foreign policy, it's maybe not the most heartening thing.
Yeah. We saw, of course, Hillary last Thursday shatter the glass ceiling here in America and become the first woman to be a major party nominee for president. I know, obviously, Thatcher came in the 80s before Theresa May here, but was there a big deal made out of the fact that she is a woman in a traditionally male-occupied position?
Yeah, there was something made of it, and there were certainly some within the Conservative Party, like a lot of the female MPs who, in the more recent intakes, who did want to see that happen again. It's a little odd because her official stance as someone who, you know, is a conservative and so takes that view of the world, but also who is trying to navigate that fact as prime minister, is okay, it's good and it's a victory, but it's not like an important thing. The main reason I got elected is I can do the job properly and I am the safest pair of hands. And she had a line at the first Prime Minister's questions where there was some debate over the Conservative treatment of women, and she said, well, the way that they treat women is to make them Prime Minister, and that, you know, they got a big cheer from the back benches or whatever. It's a very interesting thing because Margaret Thatcher, what I said earlier about a lot of this kind of hero worship being devoted to men, Thatcher is maybe the one obvious exception to that. And she by herself, like, as someone who did used to be a true believer in her back in the day and who, you know, has done a lot of like research and reading up on the way, on like the political context at the time, she is a fascinating figure, and the whole gender dynamics surrounding her are a big part of that. Suffice to say, in 1975 or whatever, there was no like great base of feminist sentiment within the Conservative Party, but it was more a case of, we don't care that she's a woman, we care that she is the best hope that we have of winning the next election, which is, and always has been, the party's foremost priority. And the Conservatives, like, you wouldn't, there's no reason to know this unless you follow like European politics or whatever, but in terms of parties which have survived in the same form and been successful, the Conservatives have to be near the top of the list, just almost globally, because they have been an election-winning force for over a century now. And even in like their lowest period, when Blair was in power and it looked like they would never come back from it, they managed to under Cameron, and it looks like they're going to be in a new era of Conservative hegemony for a while now, because Labour really is not getting their act together.
Well, you talk about things like abortion not being even an issue in England or whatever, where that's certainly a very contentious issue here in America. What's the difference between the Conservative Party in America and the GOP? Or excuse me, the Conservative Party in England and the GOP?
Right. So the political climate on the whole is more secular. I mean, that changes a bit when you get into Ireland, because that's been a whole thing in itself. But at least in England, that's never really been an issue. Or at least the influence of religious figures over politics is greatly diminished. And so if they announce a change to the abortion law tomorrow, let's say, you would have like the archbishops or whatever weighing in on it, but they wouldn't have the same kind of political clout, that their equivalents would have over in the US. And so that goes for religion. It goes for other kind of social attitudes too. Like we had gay marriage a few years ago, so not kind of, we weren't like greatly ahead of the US or anything, but there was a lot less uproar over it. It was more a case of like, okay, the time has finally come and we probably should have done this already, so let's just get it out the way and get it over with.
This is what I was talking about earlier when I said that Europe and Asia are going to blow past America because they are approaching their societies with the right set of priorities.
Well, see, it depends, right? Because you have Trump-like politicians and movements growing in popularity in Europe. You have all of these issues that I alluded to in Asia. So I think just making a statement like that, it reminds me of the kind of thing that you would see on Reddit, where it's like, okay, of course we're going to just say European exceptionalism almost. But yeah, it's not really, like the set of political issues is very different over here.
Well, what I mean is...
For better and for worse.
I'm not saying for sure. I'm saying at this pace, if these continue to be our collective priorities as a society, America is going to get lapped quickly by these other continents.
Well, so you can imagine, let's say, there are some parts of Europe which will be more socially enlightened, however you want to define that, but which will be lagging way behind economically.
Well, I mean, look, you can then go to the Middle East and they'll be stuck in the year 1200 forever because they can't get over Islam. But
right, and yet they're still very important. I see where you're coming from, and I take your point.
So you said Nigel is nowhere to be found now. He's off. He's retired. Gone. He's off at the sweater factory for the rest of his life.
I believe we don't know who his replacement is going to be, but that's the thing. Like, a lot of people were drawn to UKIP not because of UKIP, but because of Nigel Farage just relentlessly working himself into the media, which he did a very good job of. And so whoever his replacement is going to have a lot less star power, a lot less power to command public attention. And I expect we're going to see UKIP support not diminish entirely, because it's, you know, there are still like there's a well of sentiment there that they're tapping into, but it's going to kind of slowly wither away, I think, as time goes by and as they fail to really get their voice heard.
I've been pretty firm in not being interested in watching any international Big Brother seasons, with the a couple of exceptions made for Big Brother Canada. We'll see about that. If that continues, I would definitely tune in. If we can get Nigel on Celebrity Big Brother on in the UK now that he's got a bunch of free time, I'm watching those live feeds 24 hours a day.
Does the name George Galloway mean anything to you?
It sure doesn't, should it?
Okay, so George Galloway is this, like, far left firebrand figure who made a big name for himself in public, who whatever the like anti-Western cause is, he's the type of person who would take it up. Like, you know the type of person I'm talking about. And he part of his notoriety came when he went in the Celebrity Big Brother house and was like licking cream off someone, like in a cat costume or something. I forget the details, but he look, that's the enduring public image of George Galloway now.
Nice. I'm glad. I can't believe I missed that.
Well, a lot of us over here wish we had, because it's not the most pleasant thing to think about, but in any case, so Theresa May is in power now, and she's in this honeymoon period where people want to give her a chance and see how she's going to react to things. The thing is, her public image, she was the person who identified the Tories as the nasty party, quote-unquote, like 15 years ago, and identified the need to reform their image. And so that was like the basis for the whole Cameron project, although she herself, just image-wise and policy-wise, never really fit into that mold. Her public image the whole time has been, you may not like me, you may not completely agree with what I'm doing, but I have like the steel that's needed to tackle these tough problems, which obviously sounds very familiar.
Yeah, I mean, she very much, to me, what little I've seen of her, very much a Professor McGonagall vibe.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that works to her advantage. And if you look at the polls that have been taken at the moment, it's like, on the question of who do you think is the strongest leader or who would make the best prime minister, she leads by some obscene margin over everybody else, just because not just because they're in disarray, but because she has done such good work at cultivating that. But I remember thinking, like, 2010, 2011, she was always the person who would be the government representative on the, like, political talk shows and everything. And I remember thinking, like, she never actually really says anything. Like, she makes a case for the government. She makes the talking points as she's meant to. But you listen to what she says, and she doesn't. You don't come away with any really great, forceful impression. And so I don't know if that's really changed over the past few years or something, but she definitely gives off this more authoritative vibe now than she did back then. You also, if you listen to the reports of people who have been working with her or have had to work with her, then they all say she can be difficult to work for, in the sense that, like, she doesn't really listen to criticism. She doesn't really handle other points of view. She just kind of stamps her will on things and goes with it, which is the same criticism that was made of Margaret Thatcher, and which Margaret Thatcher took ownership of and really ran with too. So the legacy of Margaret Thatcher continues to define the party to this day, even if it's trying to avoid any association with her. And Theresa May, I think because she is like the second female leader of the party, the second female prime minister ever, she can't avoid being cast in that mold by some people, whether she would want to or not. And so she has to, like, accept that and cast that in her own way.
It sounds a lot to me, and I'm sure plenty of people listening along are thinking the same thing. She sounds somewhat like Hillary, like that same kind of attitude. And I, for one, am very much more of a fan of the idea that we are potentially going to be a few months from now looking at Theresa May and Hillary in charge, rather than this time last month we were thinking about the prospect of it being Boris and Donald Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the main difference between Theresa May and Hillary is Theresa May is there's no sense of, like, pandering with her. Like, I don't think she would know how to pander. I mean, she is politically aware. She does what she can to cultivate votes from all areas of the party, but she's not, like, pretending to be down with the youth or whatever. She's not, you know, she almost acts the other way, where she makes a big deal messaging wise out of not being that person, out of being someone who is quite old school, not very flashy, not always talking to the media, but just getting on with the job. And that is seen as a refreshing change after 10 years of Blair and then 6 years of Cameron, who basically was the heir to Blair, the self-styled heir to Blair. So it's a change of pace, and she's making sure everyone knows that it's a change of pace too.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds a lot like we were saying earlier about how Trump and Bernie seem to take control, or maybe not take control, but build up a sizable followings just being the truth to power candidates. Like, she's not giving you the politically correct answer. She's saying, I'm regardless of what you want to hear, this is what I'm going to do because it needs to get done.
Yeah. And so let's turn to the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn quickly, because one of the questions that we had was, what are the similarities and differences between Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders? Because on the surface, there seem to be very similar people doing very similar things. And it's, as a Brit, it's been weird to see, like, Americans on Twitter, like Twitter comedians who were Sanders supporters, make the same arguments in favor of Jeremy Corbyn, even though they don't really know anything about him or the situation. It's just they know that he's coming under attack from his own party in kind of the same way that Bernie Sanders did. And so you have, like you have these people emerging from the 12 layers of irony that they usually coat themselves in to, like, make these very earnest points in favor of Jeremy Corbyn, which is always kind of discordant to see. But I think the main differences are Jeremy Corbyn is trying to lead a political party. And, of course, Bernie Sanders is running for president or ran for president. If he won, he would have to lead this vast administrative structure and work with all of these different areas of not only his party, but also the GOP, and so on and so forth. And running a campaign is tough in itself. But I think trying to directly become a leader of a party takes some skills that you don't necessarily need to have, at least in the early stages of a presidential campaign. And Jeremy Corbyn, by all accounts, just does not have those skills. He's not really able to lead a team. He's not able to make people feel that their views are being listened to and welcomed. And he's not able to get people to rally behind him, even when they disagree with him on certain things. So he has this very hardcore fan base, but those are the people who were always going to be drawn to him and to whoever represented his set of principles, as opposed to people who think, well, I don't really agree with him on everything, but he has these other qualities, he has the electability and so on that I really like. I think he's also a lot less convincing as a figure than Sanders is, where Sanders does a good job. He's not the best orator, but he does a good job of like setting the fire under the base and getting them excited. With Jeremy Corbyn, that excitement is projected onto him, if you like. He's not the type to really invoke that himself. I'd also say Bernie Sanders is focusing fairly relentlessly on the economy, and people have argued to the detriment of his other messages, where, you know, his whole campaign was about, we need to fix the campaign finance system, we need to fix the student debt crisis, we need to fix all of these other things. And it was a very rigidly economics-focused stance in the way that you would expect a socialist campaign to be run. With Jeremy Corbyn, and this speaks to a lot of the British left in general, there's this host of just random causes. So we spoke last time about that T-shirt that he wore about the Papua independence movement during the Brexit campaign. Like, that is typical of the type of thing that he and his followers get involved in. And so rather than presenting a coherent opposition to the government based on whatever the needs of the day are, he kind of just goes around whatever he wants to, whatever he feels like talking about at the time. So if he feels like talking about Palestinian independence, or he feels like talking about a crisis in Latin America, he's going to do that. And to hell with it if that's not what anyone else is focusing on at the moment.
Sounds like us.
Right, yeah. So he doesn't have like this coherent messaging in the way that Bernie Sanders did, where if you thought about Sanders, you knew what he stood for on various things. And with Corbyn, like, you know what part of the political spectrum he's firmly planted himself on, and you know what his position is going to be on any foreign policy question, because it's always the same position. But all of these kind of fundamental questions, he hasn't sketched out a clear position for himself on yet. And so to make it clear, I'll give you one recent example. So in the news at the moment is this question of, should the UK renew our nuclear missiles? And in the US, this wouldn't even come up for debate. Of course we're going to do that. In the UK, it has been a somewhat contentious issue over the years. By and large, the mainstream body of both parties in Parliament has said, okay, obviously we're just going to renew it and that's fine. But, you know, the Lib Dems and part of the Labour Party and so on, there's always been this issue there on the fringes. So Jeremy Corbyn was on those fringes for a long time. Back in the 80s and the 90s, clearly an opponent of nuclear weapons. However, he's now leading a party who is adamantly in favor, at least in Parliament, of keeping those weapons in place. So he eventually gives in, but he doesn't want to fully sell out his own principles. So he decides to strike this bizarre compromise where we're going to keep the ships and keep the jobs involved in building all the ships and everything, but we're not going to keep the nuclear warheads themselves fully operational, which raises a question of, like, why have the ships and the submarines in the first place if you're not going to keep them as a natural deterrent? But it's like, that's the kind of thing where he ends up trying to pivot between two sides and end up really appeasing nobody in the process.
So how do we, where, when do we get to the actual impact of you guys Brexiting? When is that going to come into play? When are we going to feel anything from that?
So I'll get to that in a second. But so this coup that we mentioned against Jeremy Corbyn on our most recent podcast, that is still kind of in progress. It looks like it's going to fail, by the way. He had this vote of no confidence, this overwhelming vote of no confidence from his MPs, and basically said, well, I'm not going. It's not your decision to make. We're going to send this to the members and have them vote on it. And when they do vote in the next few weeks, he's going to win probably by an overwhelming margin again. And so you're going to have him leading a party of MPs who overwhelmingly voted to kick him out, and he just refused to go. And so now he has to somehow keep them on board with him, even though they don't really want him, and he really doesn't want them. So that's going to be a weird path for him to walk. But his poll ratings just across the board have been absolutely just catastrophically bad. And there's this sense of, like, impending doom in the party of, like, if we don't solve this issue, and by this issue we mean him, then we're just, like, that's it. It's lights out for a generation. And there's no obvious way that we can come back from this. And so there's been talk of some in the Labour Party of just splitting off and, like, letting him and his core band of supporters run the party, and we're going to have our new party that's going to be the mainstream voice on the left, although that's probably not going to work. There are some people who think, well, this is a disaster, but we're just going to try and make the best of it and hopefully guide him in the right direction. But it's taken longer for them to work out their own internal differences over this coup than it has for the Conservatives to have one prime minister resign, elect a new prime minister, and then have that prime minister go into office and start the job. So that kind of ruthless efficiency is just nowhere to be found within the Labour Party, and it's very much on display at the moment. So that's the domestic political situation and the fallout from Brexit, which is still unfolding. In terms of Brexit itself, so the question previously was, when do we invoke Article 50, which is the mechanism by which we put that two-year deadline in place for when things have to be filled out by. And the line at the time was, well, we're going to wait until the new prime minister takes over because it's going to be their job, so it should be their decision. And Theresa May has said, well, we're not going to do it this year. It's going to be probably at the start of next year once the people in those roles have had time to kind of get accustomed to it, and we've had time to solidify what our position is going to be. Those positions at the moment are constantly changing because it's still like in this... it's still up in the air, still in this process of flux. So who knows how long it will take for that to work itself out. But when we do, like if they do go for that in let's say January, February, whatever, you're going to have a very heated debate about it in Parliament because, like, as I said, Theresa May has this majority of like between 10 and 20. And a lot of those people in her own party voted for Brexit. A lot of them voted to remain in. You have people in the Labour Party, the vast majority of whom were for remaining, but some were for leaving too. And so, like, there's no possible way that she can get this through Parliament without a lot of acrimony, a lot of negotiations being made, lots of deals being struck. And it's going to be the first real test of her premiership. And she's going to be, like, she's not going in the shallow end here. This is one of the toughest things that she's going to have to deal with, and she's going to have to deal with it very soon and very quickly.
Are you worried? Are you worried that she's not going to be able to handle it, or that things aren't going to go as planned, or that there's going to be some unforeseen fallout? Or are you still thinking that this is going to go smoothly and that everyone was overreacting and wanting to stay?
Well, so when we spoke about the consequences, we were talking about like the medium-term to long-term economic consequences, the diplomatic consequences, and so on, and less about the political fallout, which I think everybody knew, regardless of the outcome, is going to be fairly momentous. Obviously, more so given that we did, in fact, leave, and now we toppled a prime minister, we've got a new one in, and so on. But there is a question of, like, how will that domestic situation carry over to the actual Brexit negotiations, and that does remain to be seen, and that could end up derailing a lot of things. One point that has been made frequently is, so a lot of the trade deals that have been struck independently between various countries took a very long time to work out, even when the countries themselves were quite small, or when the deal wasn't that comprehensive. And Britain, as the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world, it's going to be a lot more complicated than it was for many of them. And so there is this general sense of like, okay, even if we do invoke Article 50, we do move towards Brexit, and that does get put in place, the actual kind of like patchwork of agreements that we're going to need to assemble after that could easily take, you know, 5 or maybe even 10 years to really put in place properly. And so we won't know what the post-Brexit situation is properly until like 2020 something. That's colouring the way that people are viewing the recent news, where so a lot of points are being made politically on both sides about, well, this company said they were going to leave after Brexit because the economic conditions would be bad, but they haven't left yet. Or, well, this country or this company did in fact leave, and they're taking their headquarters elsewhere. That's not a reaction to Brexit. It's a reaction to like a vote that confirmed that at some point in the future there probably will be Brexit, right? But we don't know when that's going to be or what the fallout's going to be. So it's hard to judge what the actual consequences are when the process of leading to those consequences, we've got through the first stage, and that was like the big dramatic moment, but the longer second stage of that is barely even in motion yet.
But how is that any different if people are saying, hey, even if you just vote to leave, we don't have to actually leave, the mere votes to leave will result in this and this happening, and this company leaving, and these passports expiring or whatever? What difference does it make?
So let's say a company has to make a decision in the next 2 years for where their headquarters is going to be in the short term or the medium term. The incentives facing that decision are going to be very different now from, let's say, in 2 years when Article 50 has been invoked, from in 5 years' time when maybe there's an independent trade agreement in place with another country, and so on and so forth. And so for those companies making those decisions now, it's obviously going to change a lot depending on what the exact situation is. And given that that's going to be changing constantly over the next few years, it's tough to say that any one decision by any one entity or person is like tied to Brexit in a definitive sense.
So you're not sleepless every night regretting your vote?
No, I'm not. I mean, it's like I said, it's possible that in like 5 or 10 years I will be, but even in that case, it's hard to know if I should be compared to what would have come otherwise. And also, like, we legitimately don't know what that's going to look like yet. And the consensus is we're going to push for something that looks quite a bit like what we have already. But then there are people in the party, including Theresa May and one of the people leading the negotiations, who want to modify that deal and have something quite different in place with different immigration rules. But then like France and Germany have come back and said that there's no way you can have that and still be in the single market. So it's even that fundamental question is unresolved as of now.
All right. Well, what else do we need the people to be knowing right now as things pertain to Brexit or the U.S. election or whatever else? Because it is incredibly early in the morning for both of us.
Yeah, so I think that covers it for now. If there's other stuff that you want us to talk about, if you want to hear something like this again, please do write in and let us know. The reception to the first two parts was very good. I don't know how the reception to this part will be, but I guess we'll find out. If you're even hearing this and you have made it this far in, thank you for sticking with us this whole time. Hopefully you've found what we had to say interesting. And if you do take issue with any of it or you'd like to debate us, then by all means get in touch. We do want to have conversations about this. So, yeah, reach out and let us know. Give us feedback. And we've enjoyed talking about it now, and we hope to talk to you guys all about it soon.
Definitely. You can be following Dom on Twitter at DomHRV. I can be found at Colin Stone. You can email us, domandcolin@gmail.com. Josh Wigler talking Survivor and the Genius coming up very, very soon. Very pumped for that. I think that's going to do it for today. Take care, everybody.